everybody. Welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I'm joined tonight for our annual recap of the year, our favorite movies of the year 2012, by Doug.
Hey everyone.
And JB.
We made it through another year. Take that, all my doctors.
Yay, everybody. Remember, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us on DVD Verdict at dvdverdict.com. Thanks to everybody for hosting us at DVD Verdict. And remember, while you're there, to check out one of the other movie podcasts. There's a new movie-themed podcast every day on DVD Verdict. And what was the other
iTunes thing?
iTunes, yes. If you like our show, if you enjoy our show, and you want to see other people start to like our show, you should leave us a review in iTunes.
And even if they can't leave a review, they should still star it.
Yeah.
I would suggestion 5 stars.
And fairly recently we got some new reviews.
Yeah.
And they're all glowing except for one where the person doesn't quite know how sarcasm works. So you could read it and think it's a glowing review and then you look at it again and you're like, I think they meant the opposite, but I'll take the review.
Oh, I love F This Movie so much. They're so funny. And they don't make me feel like an idiot at all.
Is it the 5 O's that clued you in on so? You're like, wait a minute. Nobody who's sincere uses that many O's, guys.
I think the person had a real problem with how thoughtfully we express our opinions and justify our biases. Big problem with that.
Well, that's why in 2013, we're not going to do that starting tonight.
Yeah, I'm going to be totally biased. Biased means racist, right? Because I am totally that.
If you haven't been paying attention, we recently announced that our second F This Movie Fest will be taking place on February 2nd. See what we did?
2-2.
Number two on 2-2.
Let's call it the deuce.
Doug's it'll be number two, all right.
On 2-2.
2-2-13, the day before the Super Bowl, so it's a whole weekend of fun if you like the footballs.
Sign up for Twitter if you're not on Twitter already and follow F This Movie. And stay tuned to fthismovie.net for the announcement of this year's lineup.
And when is that?
I don't know.
And when will we be told?
Sometime.
Fair enough.
I'm thinking February 1st.
A quick little thing.
For you guys. I'm going to tell everybody else before then.
A quick thing, too, if you can, to spread the word. Jesus, I know, it's not been announced, the lineup, the year. It's not been announced, even though
the year is 2013. Everyone knows that.
People can infer that. They shouldn't assume anything.
It's all movies from 1991. I know that.
Thank you. But if you can, once we announce the lineup, and if you're excited about this as we are, if you could reach out to people and kind of spread the word, that'd be great. I'm going to keep, if I'm on a podcast between now and the fest, I'm going to keep reminding everyone.
Do you mean an F This Movie podcast or any other?
Any other podcast. I do lots of other podcasts. My religion podcast is very popular. My podcast on spelunking.
Your podcast devoted to your love of fine cigars.
That's right.
That was
fine cigars being a euphemism
for spelunking
for dookie.
Oh, got it.
So my house we always call that fine cigar.
I feel like we've gotten way off track.
Speaking of stalagmites, this morning was a doozy.
I have to go to the bathroom now and manufacture some fine cigars.
Cubans help the humidor.
That's funny because Cubans have to help it come together.
Anyway, let's talk sandwich. 2012, a year not filled with poo. We've been talking a lot about how 2012 was actually a really good year for movies. I liked a lot of stuff that came out in 2012.
And liked,
that's what I said.
Yeah. Not loved.
And I really thought that this was going to be the year that all of our lists were wildly different.
Mine will be different, I think, than most.
Okay.
This is the shittiest list I've ever... And I put out some shitty lists before.
Doug has films on his list from 1997.
Yeah.
I figured it was that kind of year.
As good as it gets, it's pretty good.
He went nostalgic this year.
Helen Hunt makes me want to be a better man.
The film was new to him.
Listen, I like Helen Hunt so much, I had to go back and look at her in As Good As It Gets when I could have watched The Sessions and gotten so much more of Helen Hunt.
Literally.
So we're going to be counting down our 10 favorites. If you are compelled to, in the thread for this podcast, if you are compelled to leave your own top 10 list, I urge you to wait. This weekend's weekend weigh-in will be your opportunity to post your own top 10 list. So let's maybe use the comments section of this podcast to react to the movies that we name as our 10 favorites.
And I think that we'll have some reactions like, you guys are full of shit.
Yeah, or
you guys
like
are
this.
Crazy.
How do you however spell you want to B-R-A-A-A-A-A-A-P.
I was thinking T-H-B, 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 T-H-B.
I have never seen such an array of fine cigars.
Let's count down. Starting with number 10, JB, feel free to go first.
My number 10 film, which I think I've mentioned several times this year, was The Grey.
Talk about a cigar.
Which I really, really liked, and I went not expecting very much. I sort of went expecting Taken in the wild.
Right.
And I got a lot more. It was a great story, well told. Liam Neeson didn't phone in his performance. It said a lot of things about a lot of things. And again, one of my favorite jokes of the year was Patrick commenting that the movie didn't do as well as people were expecting because people went expecting to see Wolf Puncher. And it was much better than that.
It was. Literally before we just started recording, we were talking about Jack Reacher.
Yes.
Not on any of our lists, I don't think. Doug?
I haven't seen it yet, but it's on my list.
Okay, good. In the coveted Ghost Protocol slot.
In the Palme d'Or section. I don't know what those words mean.
And JB, you were talking about how there were so many trailers this year that advertise a movie other than the movie that was actually made.
Yeah.
The Grey is another great example. It did good business opening weekend because all these people were expecting Taken. And then a lot of people walked out of it saying, that movie was dumb. Let me ask you a question, though, because I thought it was good. And I'm excited to see Joe Carnahan getting some recognition because I'm actually a pretty big fan of Joe Carnahan. But
you're like...
Exactly.
It reminded me of a Jack London.
When I watched Smoking Aces.
It reminded me of a Jack London story with an airplane in it.
Didn't all Jack London stories have airplanes in them?
I don't think any Jack London story had an airplane. They hadn't been invented when he did his best work.
But Jack London wrote Airplane.
No.
Was it Jack
Haley?
Oh, sorry.
Wasn't Jack
London the Tin Man,
the older brother on Boy Meets World?
Jack London wrote The Call of the Wild.
I know who Jack London was.
I know Jack London, he was in Mallrats.
No, that's Jeremy London.
He was in Days and Confused.
And he was the older brother in Boy Meets World.
It's Jack Lawrence.
What?
But getting back to The Grey.
With a different actor, do you think the movie's as good? And I say this not because of Liam Neeson's performance. I say this because of Liam Neeson's biography.
The baggage he brings.
Yeah.
Down. I think it takes you about 20 minutes to get over the fact that it's Liam Neeson, because I actually think it's a really good performance that's been bookended by all this cheese that he's done. And I haven't even seen Battleship, which you said he just phoned in.
He's barely in it, too.
I don't blame a star like Liam Neeson for doing a thing like that. I can only imagine the paycheck for Battleship is ridiculous. And I should hold him to higher standards, but I'm like, you know what? It's 2013. We got to move on, right? The world didn't blow up.
At the end of the year, yeah. Patton Oswalt, one of our favorite stand-up comedians.
Don't say our. Yours.
You don't like Patton?
I think he's fine.
Wow. He had a tweet on his, I'm a follower of her on him. He a trans?
He's got a little Jamie Lee Curtis going on.
He kind of looks like a lesbian woman. He, at Christmas time, he put out this tweet that I thought was very, very funny, and it was in quotation marks, and it said, "I won't leave until I get some. You can end this, or I can." Liam Neeson in the movie Figgy Pudding.
I take it back. I do love Patton Oswalt.
And I thought that was a stitch, I really liked The Grey, except for Jack Reacher, which I thought was the biggest and best surprise of the year.
Yeah.
Man, I thought that film was very, very entertaining. Maybe because it's based on a book. The Grey was a complete surprise. It came out in January or February?
January. Yeah.
And I find myself still thinking about it, which doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
I think it's very good. It reminds me of a horror movie. Obviously, the conventions of like the people.
The horrors of air travel?
The horrors of air travel. People, one by one, have to get knocked off in the party. I don't think that spoils anything. And my favorite parts of the movie were without the wolves. Like, I liked... I mean, there was one wolf kill when they're traveling from a destination to another destination to get cover that was, like, scary as shit.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't like that one bit. But when the wolves came, it was kind of like, oh, you know, these pesky wolves.
The scene I keep going back to is the scene near
the... You go squish now.
The scene near the end, and I don't think this is a spoiler. There's a scene near the end where he and another character are walking a very great distance. And suddenly, there are no wolves for maybe 20 minutes in the film. And the nature photography is really, really good.
It's beautiful.
And I believe the other actor said something like, I can't go on. Do you remember
yeah,
that part?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
He says,
he's done. He's done locking.
I can't walk anymore. And something about the naturescape they chose for that scene and the way it was played, again, was the opposite of this film that you're expecting. Because this was very slow and very meditative and very thoughtful and very wonderful.
Is it how you want to go out? Staring at
no,
a mountain?
No.
Being ripped apart by
wolves? You choose
wolves.
No.
I read something recently that talked about how each of the men in the party who are sort of systematically taken out of the movie represent a different type of masculinity. Anybody care to weigh in on that? Because I didn't go through and think it through. I didn't say like, well, this guy's this and this guy's this, because I didn't feel like
I'd have to see it again.
I had to masturbate.
My memory, my memory of the exposition was that they were definitely all being set up to be, oh, that's that guy.
Okay.
And that's that guy. So there might be something to it.
As the least masculine person here, I will not weigh in.
It was a good movie. A good movie. My number 10 movie is The Innkeepers. From
you
want to
go before
year.
Me?
I figured we're going around in this way. I'm going, what is this, clockwise, counterclockwise?
Yeah.
My number 10 movie is The Innkeepers, a movie I saw back in February. So apparently the beginning of the year was front-loaded with good movies. The latest slow burn ghost story from Ty West. It puts a lot of people off because it is very slow. What I really liked about it was the way that not only does it make you care about the characters in a way that I think very few horror movies do anymore, but also I really liked the way that he used a ghost story as a metaphor for sort of being stuck at a certain post-college, dead-end, working-class, minimum-wage life. I thought it was very clever.
I liked it a lot. I've actually recommended it to a couple people. My brother...
All
of them ghosts. So I thought...
You guys will get the references.
Right. my brother and his wife are... They like kind of the horror... The haunted house movie.
Yeah.
And I
said... They would love this movie called The Haunted Mansion. Tell them to check it out.
Well, when Guillermo del Toro remakes it in a year or two.
I recommended this and I said, you got it. It's kind of... No one really knows who Ty West is, especially if you're not into movies. If you're just like kind of getting what the studio gives you. And I recommended it, and I was surprised actually. They didn't have the same response I had to it. And I saw it. You showed it on Halloween for our little group of friends, and I loved it. It's actually it's on my list a little higher up.
Oh, okay.
No, it's I don't have too much to say about that you didn't already say. I found it like delightful, and I enjoyed the ride, and I thought it was great. And I think this has been talked about before too, that the two main characters are acting as if they're in a romantic comedy. And then all this kind of stuff happens, and there's a couple good boos, as I think you pointed out, that a good horror, I'm pointing to JB, a good horror movie needs a boo. It's got a couple of those, and...
You're my boo.
And it's got the foxiest instructor pilot from Top Gun ever, so what more is there to say about that?
And the first time I saw The Innkeepers was at your house, at that screening, and I have to say it left me cold, which surprised me, because I love horror films. What you just said about the metaphor of the ghost being representative of this generation that can't quite move into adulthood, that makes me like it a lot more, because I never considered that might be what it's actually about. But maybe I need to see it again.
Maybe. Again, it's not for everyone. There's basically only three performances in the movie, and I liked all three of them. Pat Healy is an actor that people might recognize, but who's really funny. Sarah Paxton's been in a bunch of stuff I've never really cared for in anything, because it's all this like teeny bop stuff, and she's really, really great and very likable and charming.
Yeah.
And Kelly McGillis turning in a good performance as sort of a washed-up TV actress, which...
A civilian, so you don't have to salute her, is my point.
And Ty West had said... Go ahead.
Go ahead.
But Ty, when I saw a screening of the movie at the Music Box, Ty West was there introducing it and did a little Q&A afterwards. And he said he wrote this part about this actress who's sort of middle-aged and washed up, believing that any actress would kill for this part because so few good parts are written for actresses at that age, not realizing that no woman in Hollywood wants to play a washed-up middle-aged
actress. Even if they are exactly
even if that.
Right.
And Kelly McGillis had no problem with it.
No, so. I really thought she was good in the film.
They want to play Mary Todd Lincoln.
At no point did I think the film was too slow.
Okay.
And I'm now starting to think that maybe the reason why I didn't like it is because I had a really bad October.
Perhaps.
Your October was great. You saw lots of scary movies with us.
Yeah. That's my memory.
Douglas, what is your number 10?
My number 10 is Life of Pi. I saw it this weekend, and it's probably the prettiest, one of the prettiest movies I've ever seen.
I thought I was the prettiest movie you'd ever seen.
You're the prettiest man-vy I've ever seen.
Oh, thank
you. It's a combination of a man and a movie that is made up right now. It's really gorgeous, and Ang Lee, I believe that's how I, Ang Lee. I didn't see it in 3D. In fact, I saw, there's only one showing in the local theater where I live. And it was filled with kids because parents didn't know that this was... It's not a kid's movie.
They thought it was The Jungle Book.
It's not a kid's movie, but it's definitely not a kid's movie. Right. But it's not an adult movie. It's
come
just
on, kids,
like,
let's go see the new Ang Lee movie.
And there's just people talking.
The Ice Storm? Yeah, kids.
I don't want to not see movies in theaters anymore, but I'm really starting to not want to see movies in theaters anymore just because it's rarely as fun as you want it to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, I saw it. I read the book, so I kind of have a little place in my heart for it. I like the book a lot. I know people out there, a lot of people don't like the book. They think it's really kind of lame and cheesy or whatever, but I like the book. And the movie did a serviceable job. It wasn't too sappy. It wasn't clumsy at all. It was fun to watch, and it was, some parts were interesting. And if nothing else, I didn't have the highs and lows that I was kind of expecting, but it really was just a feast for the eyes.
Mmm, they should put that on the poster.
It was delicious,
says Doug about this movie.
Ang Lee was a graduate student at U of I when I was an undergrad.
Really?
Yeah. Why did he not befriend me?
I don't know.
I'm just throwing that out.
I haven't seen Life of Pi, so I can't comment.
And I haven't seen it either, though it is on my list.
So should we just talk about something that we want to talk about?
I saw so many movies at the end of the year at the local 30-screen multiplex that we frequent.
With 30 screens showing, what, 8 movies?
Yeah. Well, more than that. I think there's 3 I haven't seen yet. I mean, have you... We've almost completed the scorecard, and Life of Pi is one of 3 films that I haven't seen yet.
Yeah, it's an interesting movie that I would recommend. I think, I know Patrick had always kind of, whenever I mentioned Life of Pi, he gave me a very kind of sarcastic eye roll, sneer, like,
that was my
reaction
to all the trailers, too.
It looks so good.
I don't know why it turned me off so
much. Well, it's just because it's marketed as like this kind of like feel-good whatever of the holiday season. Yeah. There's parts that are like that, but there's parts that... ask some questions, and nothing too deep.
I don't like to be asked questions during movies. I like to be given answers.
Back when IMAX was really IMAX, when there were very few IMAX screens, and like the only one was the one at Navy Pier that was truly
where
stories.
We saw Top Gun. Starring Kelly McGillis.
Oh, from The Innkeepers.
My number 10.
The original trailer for Life of Pi reminded me of one of those original IMAX movies, The Life of Whales.
Well, yeah, the trailer. I don't want to talk about the trailer because you actually saw the movie, so I'm going to like try and weigh in.
Please tell me what you thought of the trailer.
It's like, it's a boy on a raft with a tiger. Is this real or is this like a fantasy? But it's real. And then a weird electric whale jumps out of the water. It made no sense to me.
Well, and two responses to that. One is that it really is beautiful just on the surface like that. But also, just you can totally undercut that argument by saying, but Doug, so is What Dreams May Come, and that's a shit movie, so I will back down from that. But secondly,
I have to change my number 9 real quick.
There's a lot more going
on.
But not too, I mean, it's not like so much going on, but it's more of a philosophical kind of like thinking movie and whatever. And it's all right. It's all good. Right. You should see it. It's just a good movie. It's a solid sound movie.
I like that. J-Bones, number 9.
My number 9 film is Paranorman, which you nicely included in your list of favorite movie moments. I have a feeling that it didn't hold up in totality as well for you two as it did for me.
Man, I love those first 10 minutes. That walk to school really was one of my favorite scenes in any movie this year.
I believe
first
it's
starts...
one of your favorite moments in
that's what he just said.
Yeah.
When he first starts seeing the ghost.
Yeah.
The first 10 minutes of that movie I loved so much.
But I would argue, I love the first 10 minutes too.
Yeah.
The whole thing at the end with who the ghost of the witch turns out to be.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty ballsy for a children's film to present something so potentially frightening. But what a wonderful message for little kids. Frightened people will do just about anything. And I loved it. And I think I even saw it in 3D.
Okay.
It's great. It's a good movie.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff I liked in it. It didn't come together for me as well as it did for you, and honestly, one of my big problems with it, and I know this is maybe a stupid complaint, there's a lot of jokes in the movie, there's a lot of humor in the movie. I didn't think any of it was funny, or even approached being funny.
And I checked Box Office Mojo, which I should stop checking.
Because you're a box office mofo.
Tell me about it. And all of these animated films this year? No, I'm not. I'm not that thing. That took me about 7 seconds. My brain is on a 7 second tape delay. That Wreck-It Ralph made boatloads of money.
Yeah.
And Hotel Transylvania
yes.
made boatloads of money.
I think the highest grossing like,
$175 million. If I'm quoting it correctly. And poor old Paranorman that had the temerity to actually say something and not be 2 hours of cotton candy bullshit.
But isn't Wreck-It Ralph?
I didn't think Wreck-It Ralph was.
No.
I want to make a distinction. Okay. There was a lot to like about Wreck-It
Ralph. Wreck-It Ralph had Disney. Wreck-It Ralph had video games. Hotel Transylvania had Adam Sandler and Sony money. Paranorman.
Paranorman had a cool idea and very good animation.
But appealed mostly to people like us. I don't think it really appealed to kids. Maybe I'm wrong.
My wife and I sat there and watched it, we thought maybe they had worked themselves into a corner because it really is too scary for little kids.
Yeah.
And I believe it's PG?
I think so.
Yeah. So we've talked about this before. It's a film without an audience.
Is it? It's not a failure, though, I don't think. Was it a failure at the box office?
I don't know.
I thought it was like okay. It wasn't
no, Box Office Mojo was calling it a failure.
Okay. See, I'm a big Chicago Bears fan, so I went into Brave thinking that I'm going to get a lot of Bears, and I was not disappointed. It's not a very good movie.
Yeah, all right. What's my number 9? Oh, my number 9 is a documentary called The Queen of Versailles about, a very wealthy family, a man who develops and sells timeshares in Florida. He's like the timeshare king, and his wife, and they are insanely wealthy. And then the financial collapse happens in 2008.
And it hits them particularly hard.
And everything starts to disappear, and it's just a portrait of the way that they sort of cope with this. And their reactions are very, very different. There were a lot of good documentaries that came out this year. This one I thought was the most entertaining and had a lot to say and provided one of the most interesting characters in any movie I saw this year.
I thought
the wife, Jackie, I forget her last name.
Siegel,
almost rivaled Billy Mitchell from The King of Kong in just how fascinating a person she is. Because just when you think you have her pegged, she's something very different.
Yeah.
She's awful and weirdly noble. She's incredibly selfish and also at times generous. You think she's a big dummy, but she's not at all. And of the two, she's much more of the survivor, I thought.
The filmmakers struck gold because they set out to make a documentary about this insanely rich couple who are building the largest single-family house.
The most expensive,
In the country.
A palace, basically.
And then 2008 comes. And they're suddenly making a very different film. I finally caught this on Netflix, and I was really glad that I did. I thought it was a film about denial.
Sure.
The ways in which, if something has been going along one way, the inertia of our brains demands that it keep going that way, even in light of all the evidence. So at the beginning, when the financial crisis hits, it was amazing to me how often the two of them talk about the bankers and how the bankers did this to us and the bankers made us lay off these people. And then it just gets worse and worse. And I actually think it culminates in what you wrote about today, one of your favorite scenes of the year. Jackie goes to Walmart.
Which she's never done. Because they don't shop at Walmart, but now she's cutting back, quote unquote,
and
shopping at Walmart.
It's one of the clearest demonstrations of insanity I've ever seen. And I'm as acquisitive as the next person. This film will make you want to stop buying anything forever. She buys all this stuff, and then they go home and show the garage, and she's just purchased a bicycle, and the garage is full of bikes. and you buy so much.
She bought, like, Operation, or a board game, one for each kid.
Right.
Meaning, like, we've all played, you need one in a block, not in a family. But
and it gets to the point that the minute you buy all this stuff and bring it home, it loses its meaning. It becomes piles of shit.
Yeah.
And the film literally has piles of shit. Well, because no one knows to clean up after the dogs.
Or feed their pets.
It's fascinating because they had, I think at one point they mentioned they had 19 servants, drivers, maids, whatever, cooks, and they cut back and fired all of them except two or three, I think.
Yeah.
A driver and
when you first see like the little residency of the one,
yeah.
It's this tiny closet.
So sad.
You just feel horrible.
And because the one person who's working can't be expected to do everything, they're not picking up any slack. And it's to your point about inertia and about denial, like, they're not going to pick up dog crap on the floor. And it's like, well, why? It's just human to, like, be clean, but they don't know from that.
But again, and the man, this guy, becomes Charles Foster Kane,
oh.
Where he just retreats to this room where he just wants to eat and watch TV and learn bad news and comb through files and figure his way out.
And every time they show that room, you marvel at how many documents there are.
He's going to figure it out.
He's going to figure out one of these days. It almost made my list. If you see one documentary this year, make it The Queen of Versailles. It played at the Music Box for a really long time.
That's great.
Yeah. Douglas.
My number 9 is The Hunger Games. I know JB had mentioned it's one of his overrated movies.
Yeah, he was all like, P.U.
Yeah, he kind of, I wasn't here for that podcast, but
I didn't say
P.U. Tell.
No, I remember.
I listened on the podcast.
Like, I can quote it.
And I heard him put his fingers to his nose and pinch his...
See,
his,
I have a witness. Yeah,
nope. Exactly. This is what happened.
No, lies.
Two against one.
Two. Lies.
Oh, democracy.
Oh,
what's up,
you
socialist?
You're ganging up. This is bullying, which we're very big on at school right now. Apparently it's wrong. So stop bullying me. I would never hold my nose because it's got Jennifer Lawrence in it.
There you go. She's charming.
I thought it was entertaining.
There's not too much to say about it. And this is, I think, goes to a bigger point, which we've talked about briefly, and we'll talk about more, I'm sure, as we go. Like, the year is filled with lots of good movies. Good movies that I feel like I could have made a top 15 list, and on any given day, this could be swapped out for, like, a movie that didn't make my list. I saw Flight. I liked so much of certain parts of it. I like, you know, the whole sequence, obviously, where he crashes the plane. There's some personal things that speak to me. But it's like, another day, that might be in this spot, you know?
But as we've discussed, there's about an hour that's not the film that you thought.
Flight. About Flight, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So Hunger Games, I also, we talked about this on a previous podcast in a What Have You Seen Lately, so I won't go too far into this. And you guys talked about it on the last podcast, too, so... Just to suffice it to say, I liked it. It kind of worked for me. And again, I had read the books, and certain things that I was expecting I didn't pay off, and other things I didn't expect to pay off really paid off. They changed some things for the better. The direction was good. Actually way better than other kind of pap that, you know, when they have a source material that's either like a comic book or a teen novel, like sometimes like it's just... It's garbage on screen. And
a
this,
scholastic adaptation.
Yeah, and this was actually a pretty respected adaptation. And I thought it was good. I remember seeing it when it first came out and being really pleased with it.
And Stanley Tucci was in it, and he's always a thrill.
Yeah,
Steven Soderbergh shot second unit. It's science fiction that is different enough to be interesting and good. It's got, again, Jennifer Lawrence is really good, and a central female character who is a teenage girl, who is somebody that teenage girls should be looking up to.
Right.
Whose name is not Bella Swan.
Yeah.
It's
an
got
active who,
right.
who seizes her own destiny.
It's got some major garbage, too. And I don't want to talk about the garbage of the movie on the why I listed it in my number 9. But it's like...
Number 9 movie, full of shit.
It's on Epix a lot lately, so I'll catch it. And it's such a hit or miss.
By the way, Doug has Epix.
It'll be... I'll catch a great scene where there's like a thoughtful whatever scene, and then I'll catch
another scene where there's CGI flames.
It's the mutations, and it's like the dogs at the end. I'm like, oh, this is not good. Or yeah,
that was a change from the book for the better, I thought.
The flames on the dress was actually one of those examples too, where I thought it should be way cooler, and the movie didn't quite deliver.
Well, it almost seemed like there were budgetary restrictions.
Yeah, it was
something like, you guys can't afford better CGI than this, because holy cow,
weird. Oh, also, I'm not crazy about, aside from Jennifer Lawrence, like. the mixture of the male teen actors that aren't, like, it's just, they're...
No, I agree. I think the performances are all over the map. Yeah. Jennifer Lawrence is super good. Woody Harrelson is, you know, over the top, but good.
Stanley, it's funny that Stanley, good. Those, like, three, kind of, like, just
Elizabeth
bring it
Banks
home.
Is fine, you know, she's, yeah, she's playing fine. Lady Gaga. All the other, like, young actors are problematic. And unfortunately, I feel like Hunger Games is as good as it's going to get in this series, because I've read the next two books. I didn't really like them. And unless Gary Ross, who's yeah. a big reason why Hunger Games works, is not directing
the next
two.
Have they picked a director for the next
Francis
one?
Lawrence.
I don't know who that is.
He directed I Am Legend and Constantine.
Oh, no.
I couldn't have put it better myself in less than two syllables.
JB, number eight.
Okay, I have a feeling that you guys may have placed this higher up on the list.
We will silently raise our hands.
If you did, I will defer. My number eight film is Django Unchained. So we will table that. Although I do want to point out that I found myself thinking this as I made up the list, that Tarantino is so good, you can't judge his films against other people's films, because it's like, it was one of the best films of the year. It's not one of his best films.
Right, right.
But his second best is so much better than 90. Yeah. Quentin, we love you.
Yeah.
You recently did an article in Video Watchdog magazine, which I should let you guys see.
I would like that very much.
He did a list for Sight and Sound, and he allowed Tim Lucas to interview him. And most of the issue is the interview where he talks about his 50 favorite sequels.
I would like to see that very much.
It's must read.
Wow.
So you did Video Watchdog, Quentin. How about coming on our podcast?
You could talk about your favorite threequels.
We love movies, too, and Patrick once worked at a video store, just like you.
Listen, we don't...
And he's insufferable, just like you.
We're not trying to be pushy, but
if
anyone out there knows Quentin Tarantino, I can get him on the show.
So my number eight film was Django, and it's going to be higher up on these guys' lists, so let's move on.
My number eight makes an interesting companion piece to Queen of Versailles. It is Magic Mike. Which we talked about on last week's show, so I won't spend a ton of time on it, but I just think it's another interesting sort of post-financial collapse movie.
Another film that was mismarketed.
Definitely.
How does it hold up with repeat viewings? I've only seen it once.
Yeah, I watched it again on Blu-ray. I just think it's super entertaining.
Cool.
It has sort of a 70s character piece vibe, which I think
you also
had
it's
said.
Filmed.
Yeah.
Not just the opening credits that are in those antique fonts, but the whole look of the cinematography is very 70s. I only saw this film because you recommended it, and I was so glad that you did, because it was one of the better films of the summer.
I'm a big fan. It reminds me, I think I might have said this on last week's show, that it's reminiscent sort of Saturday Night Fever, where it's big
very
party,
much.
Big party, big party. Oh, it's not a party anymore. And, you know, made Channing Tatum a movie star the way that... Saturday Night Fever made John Travolta a movie star. So I guess that's all I'll say about Magic Mike.
That's
Doug,
great.
Any male strippers on your next pick?
Yes. The Great Emancipator, Lincoln. So little did you guys know, he not only is a licensed bartender, he's also a licensed stripper.
He's all 4 score and 7 minutes ago. And then he whips off his pants.
I saw Lincoln.
Party on, dudes!
Is it on anyone else's list, Lincoln? I want to survey the room before I continue.
I'm shaking my head no.
It missed my list by a hair. I really, really loved it.
Yeah, it's great, and it's not again. This year we talked about this a lot already, and we said it before the podcast, and I'll keep saying it that this is again mismarketed. There's one sequence in the first 30 seconds where there's a battle on a rain soaked battlefield where a guy's, by the way, there's a guy getting his face pushed in like a watery, muddy grave, and I'm thinking to myself, that's an actor. Like, we have to give actors more money, is what I'm saying.
I fixated on that scene, too, because, and again, when Spielberg's good, he's really good. The thought that on the battlefield you could have died by having someone drown you
is insane.
In this enormous puddle.
Right.
And from what I've read about some Civil War battles, there were some Civil War battles where the blood was so thick. That you can imagine that. And in that one detail, I think he captures.
Well, what's interesting about that, though, is it's 30 seconds of that, and then it's gone. I think at one point, Lincoln visits a battlefield, the aftermath.
Yes.
And it's harrowing and haunting, but there's no other sequences, and yet the preview is like, it shows the people with the flag charging up the hill, and it's like, man, this is just like Magic Mike, just like all these movies that are just
tricking us into getting to the theater.
Yeah,
but the movies are better than the trailers. Like, usually you get tricked by a good trailer that's advertising a shitty movie.
Right.
But these are tricking you into seeing a movie that, oh, this is so much better than the trailer.
Lincoln's suggested the same thing as The Gray. The criticism I've heard of Lincoln is that it's too talky, which I think is lunacy.
Yes.
Because what Lincoln is about, and I think they were very smart.
Hunt enough vampires.
Is that it focuses on a very short...
Wait, what are we talking... That's what I was... the movie I was referring
to. We didn't let you finish.
Yeah. Lincoln, comma, Abraham.
That Lincoln focuses on a very small period of his life, but it was so enlightening to see how little things have changed. What you really have to do in Washington,
yeah,
to get things done. And all the things about how the people have to be persuaded and those three lovable rogues who are given the job of doing it.
Spader.
Very entertaining.
I want to go back real quick. I don't mean to jump in, but you had mentioned that opening scene, and I finally saw Lincoln. And I actually thought that opening scene was super effective. And I knew going in that there wasn't more of that in the movie because you had commented on that after you saw it. That, you know, they're advertising it this way, but that's the first 30 seconds of the movie. In the same way that another movie that I think we're going to talk about opens with this very specific thing that sort of puts everything else in context, I think Lincoln does the same thing. Because that 30 seconds that he shows of the Civil War, more than just big sweeping shots of battlefields or, you know, bodies strewn about
or strategy
everywhere.
Strategy of the war, right.
Right, but just all these things that show the toll and whatever. Like, you get 30 seconds of miserable, like, practically hand-to-hand combat, people just being stabbed. It's so... The 30 seconds you see is so awful that...
It stays with you.
It stays with you, and you immediately understand, like, oh, this has to stop.
I would argue...
Americans versus Americans. This is crazy.
Yeah.
And I would argue that about an hour in... For the people in the audience who have forgotten this tremendous 30 seconds, there's a later scene where body parts are being buried.
Yes.
Which I thought was very effective.
Well, I mean, it's just the science of the era. That there, if you got a bullet in the leg or you're a really bad gash in your leg, I mean, you're losing the leg. Like
that war technology, that medical technology had not caught up to war technology. Because in World War I, of course... We have the opposite, where we can now keep guys alive...
Right. To get their gun.
Who maybe should have been allowed to die.
I like that the movie is very Spielbergian, don't get me wrong, in that there's a couple scenes where there's, like, some black soldiers coming up and reciting the Emancipation Proclamation. It's like, oh, Spielberg, yes, you will do this. And John Williams' score kind of punctuates some things occasionally that's like, well, maybe we don't need this as sweeping and kind of whatever. But I like the fact that the movie is not, and I think there was a talk when and Spielberg's been working on this movie for over 10 years or whatever, but he talked about doing a whole biopic, like, from start to finish, and this is a very specific season, almost, you know? It's the winter when this passes and then up to his assassination. Oops, spoiler.
I think he took a page. There's an amazing film that was made a long time ago by John Ford called Young Mr. Lincoln that focuses on him before he was really famous, when he was just starting out as a lawyer. And people point to that film as being so clever because everything the man became, you see in Young Mr. Lincoln.
But it's actually perfect because now you can see his whole life. You see him, Young Mr. Lincoln, you watch the John Ford movie, you want to watch The Last Days, you watch Spielberg's Lincoln, and then you get to see the middle section in which he hunts vampires. So...
It's a good thing to make the...
except for Lincoln babies.
The sweeping thing. And I thought the way they talked, I mean, from what I've gathered, too, it's a very accurate kind of portrayal of the colloquialisms and the nicknames and stuff they use. It was really interesting. It was interesting to listen to. If anything, I might have gotten a little, like, overwhelmed by it, which I want... But that only makes me want to see it again. So I'm not... I know what's going on, where I think a lot of people are like, why do they keep talking about whatever? And in a weird way... It's not like a Sorkin-esque political thing.
No.
It maybe could have used just a hint of that. Not to say it needs Sorkin at all to do a polish-up or whatever, but I thought it needed maybe just a little of that energy at some point, because it did kind of feel like one note throughout, like that this is... But I felt the couple scenes where Lincoln emphatically, and Daniel Day-Lewis does an unbelievable job, where he emphatically says things and kind of says, I want this to happen now, I'm clothed in great power, all these speeches, it's really awesome.
If Sorkin had written it, It would end with Lincoln giving this big speech at Ford's Theater, and the speech would stop the bullet. I am always...
I'm not advocating, but you know what I'm saying. I'm not advocating the sword. I'm just saying it maybe could have used a little sharpness in certain scenes, because certain scenes just almost felt like I'm reading a textbook. But it's still a great movie.
One thing I've always wished, and Daniel Day-Lewis's performance speaks to this, is I wish that Mark Twain had been recorded before he died. And that Lincoln had been recorded before he died, because I would love to hear what those two guys actually sounded like. And I think in Daniel Day-Lewis's performance, that's the closest I'm ever going to get.
From everything I've read, they said he talked whiny, he was a little higher pitched, he was soft-spoken in a lot of ways, so he did a great job.
I liked all the stuff that was very sort of process-focused, you know? And I thought all the stuff with Tommy Lee Jones was really interesting. even though I'm a little burned out on like the Tommy Lee Jones, but I just thought it was interesting the scene where he sort of has to, I don't want to spoil anything, but, compromise, whatever. The parts I took issue with were when it was Spielberg being a little bit too heavy handed.
Sure.
Some of the actors seemed to know that they were playing the villains, and
Billy Zane specifically
at times, spoke as though they knew that they were in a historical drama.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they were speaking with the perspective of somebody in 2012. But very good.
Yeah.
My number 7 film, which I haven't seen again. I do want to see it again to see if the spell will be broken. But I was very taken with it the first time that I saw it. I thought it did a lot of things really well. My number 7 film is Safety Not Guaranteed. And Patrick will speak of that later in the podcast.
What's your number 7, Patrick?
I suspect it will come up again later. It is the Ben Affleck-directed Argo.
And it will.
we will talk about that in just a minute. Again, my number 7, Argo.
My number 7, 21 Jump Street.
Go for it.
I thought, no one here? All right.
I love it.
Again, don't this is why wrong. My list is like, I don't.
There were iterations of this list where 21 Jump Street could have been on. Absolutely.
Listen, it speaks to that it's a great year for good movies, and there's a lot, this kind of movie, and I always like, and this might seem like a weird kind of internal neuroses of mine, and I think we all have different variations of this, but I wanted to include a comedy, because I think sometimes at the end of the year when you, right. It's all just drama heavy, and it's all the fighter, and like, you know, it's just too much, so at 21 Jump Street, I remember, again, the trailer comes out, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, you think it's like, what is this, another bullshit remake, and
right.
Channing Tatum before he's the Channing Tatum we know today, and I'm not a big Jonah Hill fan even,
yeah.
And this movie comes out, and I think you saw it before I did, and said, you gotta see this movie, and I did, and it's delightful, and funny, and it kind of self-aware, and it just, it's
what
a
I
fun,
love about it too
fun movie.
Is how much it understands, like, modern young people.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes a joke out of, like, James Franco's little brother.
Yeah. Barney.
I don't remember his name, Franco. But it's James Franco's little brother who plays one of the guys.
Kevin?
And the way that him and all his friends are this very sort of 2012, like, super PC. It's so great. And they have this scene where they walk through the parking lot when they go back to high school for the first time. And I included in that list of my favorite moments. Where they're trying to identify who all the groups are.
Yeah.
And it breaks down very quickly because it's like, what the fuck are they? Like, they have no idea. And I really like that it says some things about, God, I'm blanking on everybody. The main girl who's in Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yes.
You know who I'm talking about?
Probably.
The blonde girl. She's the lead actress in the movie. God, I don't remember her name either. Has some really good scenes with Jonah Hill where he is sort of speaking to all young women, like, hey, you should value yourself a little bit more.
Right.
I thought it actually said some really smart things.
Yeah.
But this is your pick. You go ahead.
You said some great things about the movie.
You're welcome.
I'll repeat, it's really funny when they take the drugs and they do the things. It's like one of the funniest little beats in movies this year, I think. And I just really liked it. And it didn't peter out, even though there's a... This is something we talked about before, too, in terms of comedies. I'll make another kind of comparison. The movie Ted is a funny movie. It's nowhere near my top 10 list, but it's a funny movie, and it's actually some of the funniest, hardest times I've laughed in the theater. Like, there's some scenes that are just ridiculous. But it does this thing that a lot of 80s comedies did, where it ends with, like, a foot chase and guns and scaling the walls at Fenway Park. Not that wasn't in 80s movies, but you know what I'm saying. And this movie, 21 Jump Street, obviously they're police officers, so it has to end with some sort of crime element, but it doesn't have that, aside from a little bit of a chase that's kind of like, well, I guess we didn't need this. It doesn't have the same, pitfalls that other movies.
And even when those things are going on, I would argue it's always really funny. I'm thinking of Channing Tatum in the back of the limo girl, or even the fate of Rob Riggle. Everything, I think, is pretty funny.
Yeah.
All summer long, Patrick kept recommending it to me and saying, it's not what you think. It's not this. It's this other thing. And I still haven't seen it, so it's my The Woman in Black.
I've seen The Woman in Black.
You're
sucker.
You're kidding.
Just for this show.
Did you bring it?
Finally saw it.
No, it's not his.
Oh, that was his.
You could borrow mine.
He's seen
I've seen it.
I thought you would bring it up. I wanted to see it. I wanted to be informed.
Okay.
What, is that your number six? Is that where we're on?
I have no idea.
Wow.
I'll tell you. We're at number six.
What a transition. Well, it is my number six
nice.
Film.
Good job, right. Everyone, especially me.
And I,
mostly Patrick.
And I felt alone in this because the movie did well, but it's certainly not making 10 best lists or anything, and it really hasn't been discussed. So I might be alone in this, and it might have struck me at a time when I needed to see it. And I haven't seen it a second time. But I really, really liked it the first time that I saw it. It had everything that I like in a horror film.
Dude, this is such a weird, and I know the answer because you just said exactly what you like in a horror movie is The Woman in Black. But do you need any kind of humor in horror? Because I don't think this movie, I like the movie a lot. But one thing it was missing for me was kind of like a, just a little like mood lightener.
No, that's a good point. It has no sense of humor. It is unremittingly grim. It has one of the grimmest endings I've ever seen.
I disagree, and that was one of my issues with it. But
and one of the things that I liked about it is because I have this thing about involving children in horror films. I really think this film earned the right to play the games that it did with kids.
Sure. Okay. I thought it was scary. I thought it had the booze that we talked about and you've talked about before.
Booze.
You like booze?
Yeah.
I like boobs. And I thought that it was a story I really hadn't seen before. Like The Innkeepers, you can make an argument that it's a pretty traditional haunted house movie.
Yeah, haunted hotel, but yeah, go
exactly.
ahead.
I liked it a lot, but the one thing, by the end of it, I was just like so sullen. I was like, this
well,
is just...
Well, yeah, that's that kind of movie.
It's grim, but here's my question. You saw it on home video, right?
Mm-hmm.
I saw it in a theater, and I have to think that for that movie, those two experiences are very different.
Yeah, I would
probably.
Agree with that.
Right.
The amount of silence in the movie and the juxtaposition of the noises when they come, I'm sure were much more effective in a theater.
So you finally saw it?
I did.
And what did you think?
I liked it and respected it. I did not love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
What you said something, though, before about how JB said that the ending.
We can't really talk about it without spoiling.
You can't say what you didn't like.
I think
about it
wants to end one way, and then somebody said, no, it has to end this way.
And I took the ending, and I think I can talk about this without spoilers, is that way too often, in fact, it's the ending of The Turn of the Screw. Well, dear reader, you've seen all the evidence. Were there ghosts, or were there not? And there comes a time in most tales like this where you got to put your cards on the table and announce. And I gave this film so much credit. I'm not a big fan of the ending, but at least they didn't cop
they
out.
They made a choice.
Definitely.
Whoa,
definitely.
Look at that.
And had it stopped there, I would have liked the ending a lot more.
Oh, so once again, we're talking about the cabin
the
in the woods phenomenon.
Ending.
What the fuck are we talking about? I don't remember this movie.
Where it ended 30 seconds earlier.
It has a second ending that I liked less. That's all.
Okay, we'll talk about this after the podcast.
Where are we at?
But, more thing. I'm not crazy for loving it.
No, you're crazy. You're
but not for loving it.
Goddamn mind. No, I don't think so.
Those two things are not mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
It's well made.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Produced by Hammer,
yeah.
The Hammer logo at the beginning, which is just stealing from Marvel, where it has all the images and the letters, but definitely feels like a Hammer movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's all Expecto Patronum
exactly.
Ghosts.
Exactly. It's all Curse of the Werewolf.
And
it
I
was
thought,
laid on a baby.
I thought Daniel Radcliffe was really, really good, and the job he had in this film was very difficult.
Yeah.
He's the whole thing.
Right.
You just had another awesome segue without even realizing it. So I'll go to my number six, The Cabin in the Woods. Anybody else?
Yep.
Okay, then we will move. move on. But that was my favorite horror movie of the year.
My number six is The Innkeepers. We talked about that briefly. I don't have too much more to say. I'm not as into horror as JB and Patrick. I like it a lot. It's not my favorite genre. I think it might be your favorite genre of
my life. It's horror.
As I'm scanning your basement, I see like a skull staring at
me. No, I don't mean all the toys. I mean my life.
I would usually say horror is my favorite genre. Scary Movie Month last year did such a number on me.
Don't worry.
I don't want to watch horror
I think
movies.
By July and August, you'll get back into it.
Yeah, in like September, I'm going to be so excited, right? I need to remember this feeling, which is like, I don't want to see any horror movies.
You know what this is like? In a bygone era, if you caught your kids smoking, one thing that some fathers would do is, here's a whole bunch of cigarettes. Smoke as much as you want. Mike made reference of this with comic book movies. So it's like, when we were kids, I love horror films so much. I can't wait. Once a year, the 3:30 movie shows horror films all week long. I wish I could watch horror films all the time. And then Satan rises from the ground. Okay, little Johnny, I'm going to give you your wish. No more horror films, please. I can't take it.
And it's January, and I'm still there. So
I think there's so many different genres of horror films, and a lot of it I don't respond to. I don't like the goth stuff. I don't like this the torture porn horror. And this horror movie...
You like it without the torture.
If there was more porn in horror, I'd be totally into it.
Porn
I don't like,
is Doug's middle name.
I don't like...
No, literally.
I don't like Japanese horror. I mean, there's just a lot of the stuff...
Because you're racist.
Well, that's part of it.
Gushiro!
There's a lot of the different types of horror that I don't respond to. And I do like The Woman in Black. And there's elements of that I like. And I do like some of the slasher stuff from the 80s. There's some of that stuff. But there's so much garbage that goes with it. I know you guys have talked about this a lot during Scary Movie Month, that horror fans are so so loyal and so dedicated that they'll sift through shit, and sometimes they forget the good stuff. And I think The Innkeepers, I think it probably turned a lot of horror fans off because of your response to it, because it's slow and because of this and that. It just worked for me, and I think part of it was the performances by the two main characters. I like the good booze. I like when a movie can take place in an environment. And this is kind of why I like, this is going to totally discredit me, but I kind of like the Paranormal Activity movies. Not for what they end up doing, but I like the fact that it takes place in a house that looks like the house that I grew up in, that it's not some haunted mansion that I've got to go spend a night in to earn, I don't know, pussy or something. But I like that the innkeepers, it's like, well, this hotel...
Your dead uncle left you pussy. You must spend one night!
You heard about my uncle?
I have to warn you, though. I have to warn you of the haunted pussy. And I believe that was the title of that film.
So I've never stayed in this specific hotel in the East Coast, but it seems like a real place.
It is a real place.
Well, unlike so many, I think another director would look at it and just make it very scary from the outside.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is just
like
it's next to a Dunkin' Donuts or something. You know,
right.
It's just,
right.
I like.
I think a lot of people that saw the movie and weren't crazy about it, I think part of the issue too is that they were expecting a big payoff or a big climax, because it is such a slow build that you're like, well, surely this is going towards something.
I thought the climax was
House
good.
Of the Devil does some of the same thing where it's like, well, okay. Again, with Innkeepers, I'm okay with it because there's sort of this inevitability that's built into the movie that they tip off very early on.
Yeah.
But whatever. I liked it.
I want to see it again, keeping your theory.
It's on Netflix.
Close
instance.
To my brain. My number five film, which might have appeared in a higher spot on some of your lists, Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master.
I haven't seen it.
And it's not on your list at all.
Not
you
on my
can't
list at
see
all.
It now. That's what sucks for me, and only me.
And oddly enough, Patrick saw it in 70mm.
I did.
It's actually coming back to Music Box in end of February in 70mm.
They had said that they were hoping to do that.
Yeah, it's three dates in end of February.
Really?
70mm.
I would like to see it in 70mm. Like all of Paul Thomas Anderson's films, I see it, and I don't really like it. And then some time passes, and I think about it, and in most cases, I see it again. I had that original reaction to Boogie Nights. The first
really?
Time I saw
you
Boogie
didn't like
Nights,
Boogie Nights the first time
I did not like it.
You were out of your mind.
I know.
We have to establish that he's crazy.
Because the other ones, I get it, but not
and
with
Magnolia,
Boogie Nights.
That film spun my head around, and that's one of the few films I can remember that had walkouts. And now we have the Master, and it took me a really long time to wrap my head around the Master, but I think it's a really fine piece of work. I think you have to be patient. It is slower than Molasses in January, but I think there are riches to be had.
Patrick, how slow is Molasses in January?
It's kind of like this.
Oh my God, that's so
no,
slow.
No, I'm sorry, that's a little fast. Hold on.
At this point, I show my age. It was unlike any other film I saw this year,
that's
which
true.
I gave a lot of credit to two films on my list. Boy, I've never seen anything like that before. Philip Seymour Hoffman, an amazing performance that I haven't seen him give. And Phoenix, that's...
Where'd that come from? I think the actor, not the actress... I think there have been so many good performances by male actors this year. Like, really good. Like Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln,
John
like Denzel Washington
in
Flight, like John Hawks in The Sessions. I think Joaquin Phoenix is in a different league.
If you watch,
he is on another planet.
If you watch Joaquin
he's so
Phoenix
good in that movie.
In Gladiator.
In Parenthood.
You would not think he could ever...
Oh, no, he's awful in
And
Gladiator.
He was nominated for an Oscar for Gladiator.
Right, and
I
that's...
remember
what,
that
it's
and
like you watch him in Gladiator, and what was it?
Ladder 49.
Ladder
yeah.
49, and he's like, he's made progress, and then he did that whole thing where he was a performance artist and
right.
went away. And I think that maybe gave him some perspective.
He was very good in the Johnny Cash movie, though, I thought.
Yeah.
But
he's on another planet in The Master.
Well, I haven't seen it. I actually had a chance. This is just me talking personally for 2 seconds. I had a chance to see it with Patrick. I think you were going to go, and you didn't have an extra ticket, but there might have been one or something. And I'm like, no, I've got a date with my wife to see The Amazing Spider-Man. And I felt bad because we had plans, and we were going to see this movie we had talked about. And I saw The Amazing Spider-Man at the patio, and it was like 100 degrees, and it would smell like a foot.
And The Amazing Spider-Man was showing.
Exactly, and my eyes were bleeding. And I'm like, I could be watching The Master right now on 70mm Music Box. And I didn't. And then I missed it when it was like out for 3 weeks.
That's the one screening this year that I wish I had attended. I don't know what I was thinking.
Fascinating movie. Very well made. Needs to be seen, I think, more than once.
Well, to JB's point, you when you first saw There Will Be Blood... You didn't hate it, obviously, but you're kind of like, well, this is weird, you know, and now it's one of your favorite movies, I think, right?
I really love it. To be fair, I was very sick when I saw There Will Be Blood, but yeah, I think because I went in expecting, Paul Thomas Anderson was one of my favorite directors, if not maybe my favorite director, just based on Boogie Nights and Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love, and There Will Be Blood was not that. And I had read so much hype about There Will Be Blood is the future of movies, it changes cinema. People actually said these words. And to me, it seemed very sort of like obvious. It's this over and over and over again. Since then, I've come to appreciate it a lot more. So I didn't respond immediately to The Master. I'm cautious about it because I liked so much of what I saw, but I didn't fall in love with it. So I know I need to give it another chance.
And much like Synecdoche, New York, which I've talked about, I'm beginning to think maybe it's my dotage or something, maybe it's my old age, that when something really terrific comes along, I can't wrap my head around it the first time.
Yeah. Is that how Synecdoche is? Synecdoche, whatever
it is? The first time I saw it, I didn't know what to think of it.
I've got it on my DVR.
That's a little bit how I am with The Master.
It spun my head around, and then I saw it first at Ebert Fest.
Yeah.
Where
he
Charlie Kaufman...
He champions it, right?
Oh, he says it's the best film of the aughties, or whatever you want to call it, the early 2000s. And Charlie Kaufman was there... being very polite to some of the worst questions I've ever heard at a question-answer session. And then
Where's your brother Donald? May he rest in peace.
And then 3 weeks later, I saw it on cable, and Synecdoche, New York is a masterpiece that says all sorts of really interesting things about all sorts of really important life issues. One of the greatest last lines in film history.
I have to see it. It's on my DVR.
Where are we at?
We are at your fifth.
My number five is Looper.
That's higher on mine.
We will come back to it.
My number five is Django Unchained, and that's higher on Patrick. So let's come back to this. So now my number five is Django. Patrick's number five is Looper. JB, you're number four.
And my number eight was Django.
Yeah.
And Looper came this close to making the list. My number four, Beasts of the Southern Wild, which almost fell off the list. Because the last time we discussed this...
And skyrocketed back to number four.
Yes. Because again, like The Master, I give so much... I've seen a lot of movies.
Yeah.
And I've never seen that before. You brought up the last time we discussed this on the podcast, The Beasts.
Mm-hmm.
and I'm having a real hard time wrapping my head around the beasts. Yeah. I disagree that the film is racist. I've said this before. For the first 20 minutes, I thought it was a documentary. It's just one of the goddamnedest things I've ever seen. And doesn't that count for something?
I liked the photography a lot. I liked the score a real lot. It was different than a lot of things I've seen.
The performance of the little girl?
Yeah.
Remarkably unchild actor.
She auditioned when she was 5, and then she performed it when she was 6 and 7. That alone is unbelievable. That is just crazy. I am not typically contrarian. I try not, in all seriousness, I try not to be. I try to, like, have an open mind and stuff. In this last week and a half run up to this show, I tried to see so much, and I saw double features and triple features, and Patrick was gracious enough to let me borrow some stuff and see some stuff at his place. And I watched Beasts of the Southern Wild on Amazon Prime, because I'm like, I think I knew that you really responded to it, and it made a couple other people's top 10 lists. And I'm like, what is this movie I don't really know anything about? I can't even explain my reaction to it. Like, I feel like I get it, but none of it worked for me. Like, and I can't, again, without, you know, judging your judgment of it or whatever, like, I can see why it would work for somebody. Like, to Patrick's point, I think it was beautiful, like, the way it looked. And even the opening scene, she has these fireworks, and she's doing this, and it's like this rack focus where she's out of focus, and she's in focus, and it's this white cloud, and it's like, wow, that's beautiful. Music's awesome, and she's awesome, and I get the symbolism, you know, the fairy to the Elysium, and it's like, I get the Greek, whatever, all that mythology stuff. But I felt like I was watching a student film project. I just felt like none of it worked for me. It didn't fire at all. And I turned to my wife at the end, and who liked it a little more than me. And I just was like, I feel like I should watch it again, which is the weirdest reaction to a movie that you don't like, that you feel like you should watch again, because I'm like, I know people I respect, like you, really responded to it. So I'm fascinated by it. So maybe another time we could talk and you could explain it.
Very briefly, I thought one of the things it was about was ethnocentricity, that when we first see how these people live, we might think, this is the most awful thing I've ever seen, and are they a primitive tribe? But that's just us looking at them through our lens. So the scene where they finally take her to that infirmary, and to her, that place is as foreign as her habitat is to us, it just made me think that sometimes we look at things too much from where we are, and that there are some people who just need to be left alone.
Yeah, maybe I'm too literal, too, because I see what you're saying. And I can completely understand. I think that your conclusion that you draw is actually completely valid. But when I look at this and I'm saying, I'm looking at it through my prism of, like, that this is disgusting. And I'm like, you know, but it is. And I don't think it's just my prism. But it's like, it's just, I can't imagine, I don't know.
Well, you can argue that it's their mistake to make.
Sure, yeah.
And they're actually perversely proud of the fact that they live in this very unhospitable place that no one else wants to live in.
Right. Yeah.
There's an interesting article that Doug had emailed to me the other day, written by Vince Mancini at Film Drunk, called, like, The Case Against Beasts of Southern Wild, or The Problem with Beasts of Southern Wild. I'll try and remember to email it to you, because he lays out a lot of the problems that people who didn't like the movie have laid out, and a lot of it are accusations of sort of this racism, and that the movie is holding up these people, suggesting that that they're more in touch with the earth, and that, you know, it's...
No, I never thought that.
It'd be interesting for you to read, just so you could sort of disagree with it.
It's kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's purposely inflammatory.
Yeah,
I think he writes to be funny, and he writes extremes and hyperboles to kind of prove his point.
Right.
Overall, I still agree with what he's trying to say.
He calls it a great-looking MGMT video.
Oh my God, I thought that was really funny, because it felt like a music video, but it's like, oh no, it's 90 minutes of this, and
people have a problem, too, with the fact that the play that it's based on is about two white people.
Yeah, in Georgia.
In Georgia, not New Orleans. And that the movie is directed by, like, a white guy from Brooklyn.
Oh, okay, so he's
not allowed to make a movie about it. But that'll come up again, maybe.
That is kind of crazy. Like, I got to defend that to the nth degree.
Well,
like,
Quentin Tarantino then shouldn't make Django, right?
You make whatever you want if you have something to say about it. But
right. It was unlike any other film I saw this year.
Yeah, I agree with that.
My number four is Safety Not Guaranteed, which JB had mentioned a little bit earlier. For a while this year, it was my favorite movie of the year. it had the potential to be so nauseatingly
twee.
Yeah, to be sort of the, I think Little Miss Sunshine is the movie that you always hold up as the indie movie that has all these pieces.
I would actually argue, and this is going to infuriate you too,
okay,
that if Safety Not Guaranteed had gone wrong,
yeah,
it would be Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
Interesting. I mean, it doesn't infuriate me at all, okay. But I don't even know if I agree with that. But that's okay. It just has all these pieces about, like, the guy who wants to travel in time and the indie rock soundtrack and the hip cast of up-and-comers or whatever. It could have gone so wrong, and I think it is really good. I think it's funny while not an outright comedy. And I really like the things that it has to say about the way that, I don't know how to say this without sounding like super pretentious or douchey. Like,
but the reason why the film worked is that it never got pretentious or douchey.
No.
Dealing with material that could have been uber pretentious.
Right.
And I think one of the things that it's about is that time travel is a metaphor for the fact that we're all just trying to get things right.
Right. Or the way that we sometimes will live in the past.
And the elusive
as a means of
nature,
sort of time travel.
The elusive nature of the past.
That we're all trying to get back to the past through ways other than building a time machine. But I also think, and this is one of the interesting things, because I think so many people wrote that movie off before it came out, based on the trailer, based on the concept, based on the fact that, hey, this just looks like another garbage festival movie from, like, 1998. And the way that the movie is very much about, there are two ways that you could sort of choose to live your life, being ironic or being sort of sincere. And you would think, based on what people sort of pigeonholed this movie as being, that it would definitely choose irony, that we're supposed to laugh at this goofball who is building a time machine or whatever. I just really like that it's about sort of this battle between irony and sincerity, and the movie comes very firmly down on one side. And I guess I won't spoil which side it comes down on, but I thought that was great. I thought better, more than any other movie this year, I thought the way that it handled that sort of debate, was really great.
It's Mark Duplass, right?
Yeah.
He's new to me. I know he's not new to everyone. He's a musician, you told me, and he, is a director with his brother and has done some other things. He's fascinating. He's in Zero Dark Thirty also, is a great little small part. My wife is like, it's her new favorite actor. And the song he plays, you pointed out in the thing you wrote today about the best moments, it is, and the last song in the movie is just wonderful. I actually like this movie a lot, and I like the subplot, too.
And that's the Jake Johnson stuff is sort of about trying to travel back to the past just by...
Absolutely, and it could be its own movie, and it's like, it's just kind of the minor thing here, but it's like the performances, it's nothing what you expect. You think it's going to be like, oh, he's going to meet her, it's going to be gross and fat, and, you know, or whatever, you know, and it's not. It's just so much more thoughtful than that.
And Aubrey Plaza, who's become sort of the poster girl for hipster irony, who exists just to roll her eyes at things and make sarcastic comments, I thought was used to really good effect and was really good in the movie.
Yeah. My number four is probably the most personal of all my choices, and it's made no top 10 lists, and I cannot defend it. I will defend it, but I don't
you
think
better.
My defense is valid. It's Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean,
funny the way this keeps working out, though.
It doesn't work for a lot of people, and I actually want to lean on something JB had said last year about Hugo, which was your number one, that for whatever reason, and correct me if I'm wrong or fill in the blanks, that it worked for, it was made just for you.
I felt it was made for just me.
Right.
And these other people got to see it too.
And it was, you loved all the beats, you loved the way it made you feel, even if that feeling was sadness, you liked it, you liked how it made you happy, you liked all these things, and you didn't want to watch it again. That's something that stuck with me that you said.
Because I wanted to break the spell. Much like wanting to hear Mark Twain's voice, being able to travel back and watch Méliès make his films.
Right.
The movie made that possible. That's the magic of the movie.
I know Patrick had seen Seeking a Friend before I did, and he rewatched it actually before I saw it for the first time. And thankfully you kept that opinion to yourself, because you said the second time you watched it, it did not, because you liked it the first time you saw it. And the second time it didn't hold up, the jokes kind of fell flat. And here's, if I really kind of quantitatively go back and think about the beats of the movie, how they travel from point A to point B to point C, and the Friendlies, I think it's called Friendlies, the restaurant, and that's what people kind of like and respond to. That scene I don't like. And there's other scenes that they do that I don't like.
Jillian Jacobs kisses a girl in that scene.
I like that. I like parts of that scene. Don't get me wrong. But I do like how the movie, in a very kind of, not lazy, but very superficial way, kind of jumps upon and highlights all the different ways that different people would react to the actual end of the world. And then it kind of shifts to this very kind of serious, and it's weird to kind of how it becomes so serious based on the superficial, light way that it treats a lot of things. The relationship with Steve Carell's father. And a quick side note, too, like, I don't like Steve Carell as an actor or as a movie actor. And let me rephrase. I think he's fine, but I think the projects he's chosen, he was so great as Michael Scott. He's so funny as the correspondent for The Daily Show. So great as Michael Scott. And then he made these movies like Date Night. And what's the one where he's like the idiot that makes
Dinner for Schmucks.
And it's like, you're a bat. You don't do this.
He's not a leading man. He's a character actor.
Right.
And Michael Scott is a character part that, because of the way the show is structured, is the lead.
Right.
But he was very good in Anchorman, and that's
exactly
a character role. He should do character parts.
I thought his unique brand of, you know,
Mopey.
Yeah, Mopey did work for this movie. And the last half hour, and this is why I don't want to watch it again, for two reasons. One is because I don't want to, if it does work again, I will feel just as sad, which I don't want to feel. And if it doesn't work again, I will then rethink how sad it made me feel. The last half hour of the movie, I was in tears. Like, I mean, without it, I was embarrassed in front of my wife that she had married such a pansy.
There is a jarring shift in tones in that film. And I'm left wondering if I would rather have a film that's all the first hour, or what if the film was an hour and a half of the last 20 minutes?
There is that film. It's called Last Night, directed by Don McKellar. It's a Canadian movie.
It's the last
20 minutes. Although I would argue that a lot of the tonal shifts are there throughout the movie, and we're sort of remembering the first hour as a wacky comedy because, again, that's how this movie was marketed.
Yeah, with, like, the Talking Head song.
There's a moment very early on where I honestly thought to myself, oh, this movie is actually something special. And again, I've sort of revised my opinion that things don't work as well for me, and I tend to remember some of the stuff I don't like more than the stuff I did like now, because I did have a really visceral, emotional reaction the first time I saw it that I didn't have the second time. It was the problems that stood out. But all right, I'm going to give this away. Sorry if you haven't seen Seeking a Friend from the End of the World.
It's not a spoiler, I don't think.
It's sort of jokey, and Steve Carell is sad, and he's driving around and everybody's crying, and it's all stuff we saw in the trailer. A lot of the trailer comes from the first couple minutes of this movie, and we cut to Steve Carell slowly pulling into the parking lot of his office building, and in the theater this was the loudest thing I'd ever heard. A body falls on the hood of his car from the roof of the, you know, somebody has killed himself. And I think it's supposed to be Rob Hubel, although it's never really made explicit.
Well, it's the same tracksuit that he's wearing.
It's so jarring and so dark that I was like, oh wow, that I didn't see that coming. Not just the guy jumping, but even that darkness, even though the movie's about the end of the world. Again, because I saw this trailer, it was like, it's wacky, it's a romantic comedy, world's ending. I don't know. And again, I appreciate the fact that the movie, like you say about The Woman in Black, puts its money where its mouth is.
Yeah, there were things in the movie I liked. I saw it. You had said that this, when you watch this movie, you can see a script with all sorts of different color pages. That it was amazing some of the darkness they were able to sneak into the film. But when I think of Seeking a Friend, it's a film full of studio notes. Or again, maybe I'm just reacting to the trailer. One of the things we're taking away from today's podcast is that one should never watch trailers.
I guess not.
This year was a bad year.
Only on Friday with Doug.
Listen. As the resident expert here on trailers, and trailers this year were horrible. They were bad. They were very, very bad.
Although I would argue that the Seeking a Friend from the End of the World trailer was good. It made me want to see the movie.
I take it back. It was good. All the trailers were great this year. Does that make you happy, Patrick?
Yes, much more so.
Boy, he turned on a dime.
I can see, again, I could see all these issues with the movie. It just, again, it so super worked for me. And again, the reconciliation with the dad, where they don't go into like why he's mad at the dad. It just kind of brief sentences, unspoken.
Yeah.
It's fixed or it's not fixed. It's mended. And then
other things happen, and there's some plot holes again that aren't the best at the end, but I like that.
But a lot of times the movie goes just this side of where you think it's going to go, yeah. And movies so rarely do that.
Which I gave it a lot of credit for.
Yeah. But all the things you just said about seeing a friend from the end of the world, keep those in mind, because we're going to get back to that exact conversation in a few spots.
Okay, cool.
Jay Bones.
We're on three.
Yes.
Yeah,
my number three film was Argo. And you put it higher than that?
I did.
So we'll table Argo.
I forget where I had it. 7. I liked it less than you guys, I guess. Apparently. Argo's super entertaining.
Your number three?
My number three movie is Zero Dark Thirty, which we will speak about momentarily.
my number three is Looper. Let's skip it.
Finally, we get to Looper.
Which, it didn't make JB's list, although he liked it a lot. It's on, what's it at your...
I don't remember, 5, I think.
It's
at
number 5, it's
just
my number 3.
Just barely, it almost made my list.
Right. Yeah. Again, in the run-up to the show, I saw a bunch of stuff. I saw this, and it stuck out to me. I don't think I've seen another Rian Johnson movie.
Brothers Blue?
I did see that. I don't remember it
at all. It's so great.
Is it? I love it. I know you love it.
I love it.
I liked so much of this movie, and I realized that this had been in Rian Johnson's head for, again, kind of like the Spielberg-Lincoln thing. That the concept of this, it was a short script treatment that he'd been playing around with for 10 years, and this is the movie that it came out with. And aside from some early on distracting Bruce Willis face by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I thought it was a pretty solid, tight movie, and that's especially hard to come by, I think, when you talk about time travel and the nuances of science fiction and the future. To make the movie kind of airtight in a lot of ways is pretty remarkable. And I loved so much of, like, the playing with time and it was very good.
I really was a huge fan of the movie. Again, here's an original science fiction movie in an era where there's so little of that. Yeah. And I'm amazed that in the same year that Prometheus comes out, where everyone is holding it up. And I bag on Prometheus like once a week on this podcast, so I apologize. But people hold that up. But look, it's original science fiction made for adults. Like, yeah, but it's really dumb. And the same year that that came out, Looper came out, which is original science fiction made for adults. Which is really smart. It has all these ideas. And all these people wanted to shoot down Looper because of weird plot holes in, like, the time travel. And disregarding the fact that I don't even necessarily agree that there are a ton of plot holes in the time travel.
No, I don't think there are.
Who gives a shit?
Right.
Because that's not what the movie is about. And the movie, again, says as much when Bruce Willis says, I don't want to talk about time travel.
Right.
That's not what the movie is about, everyone, at all. And I think a lot of people, too, again, talk about mismarketing, a very common theme, I guess, this year. Much of the marketing for Looper focused on the first half of that movie.
Sure.
And there's a whole second half that didn't make most of the trailers. And I think that left a sour taste in people's mouths, that they weren't crazy about the second half. But again, the second half is kind of what makes it all work.
Yeah, the second half is the heart of the movie.
Yeah.
And it's it focuses, without spoiling, it focuses on a little boy.
On a farm. Not flying cars and time travel in the
city. Yeah. And it's not, you know, whatever. It's such a good movie.
It was terrific. It was so well thought out. My only criticism is they didn't need to do any of the prosthetics. Excuse me, I'm choking. They didn't need to do any of the prosthetics on Joseph Gordon-Levitt. We get it.
Yeah. That's always...
I believe that he grew up to be this. I don't understand why...
We're believing that he traveled through time. Why can't we just believe that he's Bruce Willis?
It's the whole notion of, like, suspending disbelief.
People
like,
age.
If you... Like, if anything, I'm more... Like, it always throws me when you're watching a movie and, like, two-thirds in or three-quarters in, you see a celebrity playing, or a more famous person playing a bit part just for a small little thing. It's kind of neat and kind of cool, but it definitely, I think, you'd be hard-pressed to say, it doesn't suck you out of even the best movie where you see...
I love what Patrick said about Bruce Willis saying, I'm not here to talk about time travel. Do we have a second for a weird discursion?
Well, I don't think
that was done. I'm sorry.
My point is that, and I'll make this really brief, so you when you see that actor... You're kind of like, when I saw Joseph Gordon-Levitt show up as Robert Lincoln in Lincoln, and that was probably about maybe halfway through, it's like, oh, right, he's in this movie, and it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt. But from the very start, we know it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis playing these two very specific parts, and the movie tells us as much that they're the same character. There's no, like, I don't need the bridge on the nose and the colored eye contacts to whatever. Right. Yeah, it is, and it's Bruce Willis' face, and he's doing this thing, and it's like,
whatever.
Unnecessary.
Unnecessary.
So, I will withdraw the digression. It's a complete waste of time.
Okay. But I again, loved so much of, I think you pointed out today and again, the best moments of the year where you said the Paul Dano character, how he's affected by time travel and the future him and the present him is just
one
it's
of
crazy.
The most incredible sequences of the year. I also wanted to include the whole sequence where
I was just going to
Joseph Gordon-Levitt travels to.
I was going to say, I think we're going the same way. Yeah. Where it's like the timeline proceeds as if nothing changes, and he goes to China.
We see how he becomes Bruce Willis,
and basically. That is a movie I want to see. Also,
young
Bruce Willis in China.
There's a
full of ideas.
Of ideas, and the way I love what how the movie is actually about sort of this whole nature versus nurture debate. And it's very rare that a movie works both as a series of set pieces, because there's a bunch of really great set pieces in the movie, but also works as a whole. It's not just this good section and this good section and this good section. It all works together, too. Yeah. There just happen to be a bunch of really great sequences in it.
It's a terrific film.
'Tis great.
My number two...
Wait, that's...
Shit. We're back to JB.
JB at number two.
Miss it, Noonan. Miss it, Noonan. Caddyshack. My number two film is
Resident Evil.
Cabin in the
Retribution.
Woods. Which was so terrific. And I remember, what month did that come out?
April. Smarch.
I get a fevered text message from Patrick Bromley. I believe I'm at school. Go see Cabin in the Woods right now. Don't read anything about it.
Drop the chalk.
And I'm so glad that I did. And this...
And I flunked all my students.
I literally ran out of the room. Kids, I'm sorry. I know it's your education. I got a movie to see. Sayonara, suckers!
I got to the theater and found out their showings all day. Literally every 2 hours.
I thought it was leaving. So I went to see Cabin in the Woods, and it's terrific for 10 or 15 different reasons. And here... we have something very sad. This is how sad horror fans are. There's a lot of people, the smart people, who recognize Cabin in the Woods for what it is, which is magnificent, because it is at once a horror film and a meta critique of horror films. How often does that come along? And then I'm listening to people all year long tell me that they hated it, because either A, they couldn't stand the first hour, that's a recreation of the standard 70s horror film. Well, that part was really dumb. Yes, it was on purpose. And they love the last hour, and they wish the whole thing was the last hour. And curiously, I've talked to people who have the opposite opinion. All those teenagers was getting scared in that cabin. Why did it have to switch to that underground place? I don't know why I'm doing that voice. I don't know why an old drunken Southern man didn't like the film. But you can't please some people.
No.
It's so clever. It's so endlessly inventive. What Doug had said about Women in Black, talk about comedy relief.
Mm.
The Cabin in the Woods is full of it. In fact, you might argue that it has too much. It's amazing.
It's almost, to that end, though, I think it's almost a movie designed not to fail, that's too strong a word, but to not be successful, because it's not, it's made for us, and it's not made for the, if you're going in, like, I could not recommend that.
If you're going for this, you'll hate the last hour.
Exactly.
And if you're going for this,
right,
you'll hate the first hour.
If you're somebody who made Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D the number one movie in the country this weekend, because you just go see any horror movie... you might not even, I don't want to say you won't get the last hour, but I just feel like it's going to be lost on some people what the movie is saying.
I went to see Texas Chainsaw 3D.
Did you really? We have to talk about it after the podcast. I want to hear all about it.
Did you see it too?
No, I want to hear about it.
I will tell Patrick about it after the podcast.
I know that the lead character at one point refers to Leatherface as Cuz. Do your thing, cuz.
Yes.
Do your thing, cuz.
So what have you seen lately, JB?
I can sum it up to people listening to this podcast, if you weren't part
of that movie made over $20 million this weekend.
Yes, it did. It was the number one grossing film of the weekend, which
it
I believe is a biblical sign of the apocalypse. One word, miserable.
Oh, do your thing, cuz.
Miserable.
I'm fascinated, too, by how many people champion even fans of Cabin in the Woods will call it only one thing. It's this love letter to all horror movies. Or all it does is make fun of horror movies. Why would I want to see a horror movie that just... But the movie can do both, right? The movie can say, this is why we love horror movies. Here's all the reasons. Here's why they're necessary, in fact. Here's the function that they serve in our lives. At the same time, here's why they're a little bit broken. Because it's hard to argue that horror movies aren't broken right now.
We've always had a problem with films that only allow characters to be one thing, because that's not the way it is in real life. Why can't there be a film that does five things really well?
Yeah. A big critique I heard also, not scary. Which I suppose is valid, but I don't know how interested the movie is in being scary.
I actually think there's parts of that film that are scary.
It has my favorite title card of any movie last year. I saw it by myself on opening day and was laughing so loud in the theater. Turn this off if you haven't seen Cabin in the Woods for 20 seconds. It's Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins just riding on that little cart. And Bradley Whitford, like, starts to spill coffee, and he goes, oh, damn, and just, boom, Cabin in the Woods. Like, and so, even that is a joke about the things that horror movies use to scare us.
Unmotivated change of view and sound, especially the sound. Because it's like, oh, that, bam!
I laughed so hard at that.
The point at which they open all the boxes or open all the elevators, I would suggest that that's plenty scary.
I just don't see how you can be a fan of horror movies and not be in your glory in the last half hour of them. This is anything you could possibly ever want.
If horror fans do anything, they've proven to you that they're schizophrenic.
Yeah.
You know that
they're
like
everybody likes different stuff.
Patrick said
specifically they're crazy.
Oh yeah.
One of them sitting right next to us.
that Patrick diaper. Said that at the point where they showed what was in every room. That amazing shot.
Yeah. Well, don't say too much.
He said JB needs to see this.
Yeah.
They showed all the rooms. That was my number two film.
My number two, right? Was that? No.
Yeah.
Yeah. My number two is Django Unchained, which was on other lists.
Yeah.
Everybody's list.
Yeah. I put that on my list.
Yeah.
But higher up.
Mine's the number two. And I go back to what JB said. It just... I'm so in love with what Quentin Tarantino does as a director that I would agree that this is not his best movie, but I still liked it better than almost all but one other movie this year.
It's interesting about this director, and you said it. Your favorite Quentin Tarantino movie is the movie you're watching at the time, with the exception of maybe Death Proof has lots of flaws, even though Death Proof isn't unbelievably awesome movie. But you could be watching any one of them and just be like, this is... Specifically, Jackie Brown is the one that comes to mind where I'm just watching him. It's like, why haven't I thought about this every day since I've seen it? This is so good.
And he's famous for writing dialogue, and I think maybe as an English teacher, the theme in the film of language is even more pronounced than in a lot of his other films. And I remember watching Django with the two of you, if I remember correctly. And... the fact that Christoph Waltz is not speaking his native language, and he's so much better at it than anyone else. And how does everyone else respond? They hate him.
Yeah.
They hate him and his big vocabulary. Tarantino knows America.
I love so much of the movie. I think it's really smart. And I think a long time ago, people wrote off Quentin Tarantino. They give him credit for doing a lot of things, for seeing a lot of movies, for knowing a lot about movies, but I don't think they give him credit for what his movies have to say. I don't think many people acknowledge that his movies are saying something.
That they see his films as fanboy genre pastiches.
Right. And that there's so much going on in Django Unchained that's really, really interesting. Great dialogue, great, great performances. He writes fantastic characters for every actor. I go back to something that you say all the time about Universal Monster Land.
What do I say about that? Oh, you're talking about
you want to live there.
He was looking at me. Yes, I would like to live there.
And that's how I feel about... I don't actually want to live in Slavery South. That's how I feel about Quentin Tarantino World, that I saw this movie 2 weeks ago. I've thought about it every day since. I just want to like listen to the music and just be back in the world that Quentin Tarantino creates.
It's such a wild movie that it says so much about so much. I mean, its subject is slavery. I mean, how do you make a movie about slavery?
Exactly.
What you do is you make it a spaghetti western, and so often, like, the most the difficult themes are kind of explored through kind of throwaway genres. In order, and horror is a great one of them, obviously, and spaghetti westerns, even back in the civil rights, you know, they explored things. And this spaghetti western, it says so much that you can't necessarily say about, like, an Amistad could not say the things about slavery that this movie says.
And the movie's it's already made over $100 million. It's on track to be his highest grossing movie ever. And so a lot of people are seeing a movie that says some, I won't say dangerous things, because I don't think the movie is dangerous. It's very, very critical of American history.
Yeah,
as it should be. Obviously, it's about slavery, but I think it says a lot of things that people haven't heard said in a movie before. And I think a lot of people won't even know that it's being said. I think they go just to see Jamie Foxx beat some ass, and they see it, and they have a great time, and there's a lot of blood, and there's cool music, and it's fun, and everybody still just assumes that Quentin Tarantino is sort of this fluke, and he's not.
He's not, and it's funny, because even one of my critiques after I watched it was kind of like, it feels like a, you know, maybe like a throwback, like he's doing this homage to a certain era. And then I stop myself, because that's nonsense. Like, it's stupid thoughts that enter my head, because that's the first thing you see. Well, this feels like he's using this old song, and he's using this old, like, the title card is old, and it feels like something like Sergio Leone. It's not. It's so much more. And he uses those tools. It's part of his tool in his toolbox to, like, make a better film.
I even read, and then we'll stop talking about this.
No, I can talk about
it. I read, I've done a lot of reading about it. I read one very interesting thing today that I won't take credit for. But one of the big critiques of the movie from even people who like it is Quentin Tarantino's cameo is very jarring.
It is.
And he's a bad actor. But I read one thing today, and I don't want to get into too much detail because it gets into spoilers, but it even justifies his cameo. Because the thing that Jamie Foxx gets from the Quentin Tarantino character is very important. And I'll leave it at that, and we'll talk about it after the podcast.
It's ambiguous.
But if you've seen the movie, you know.
No, I didn't have a problem with his cameo. I even think that you when could... I didn't.
But then he starts talking with an Australian accent.
I didn't have a problem with it.
It's pretty ridiculous. He's all, like, stung by a bee.
That
he just, like, bloated.
In a very real way, you can see the Kill Bill films and Inglourious Basterds and Django as sort of an unofficial trilogy, although it's four movies.
It's three.
Where he's considering what is the nature of revenge and what causes it, where does it get you. It's very thoughtful.
I think another critique people had was that it had two endings.
Yeah.
And then, but you could also make a case for the second ending. You should see the movie,
yeah,
everyone. And then we'll talk about it.
I want to say something, but I think it might be a spoiler.
All right. We'll talk about it after the podcast.
We'll talk about, so none of you will benefit from that.
Douglas, you're number two, I believe we're at?
Zero Dark Thirty.
Okay.
I saw it. It just came out. Yeah.
And so did Doug.
I did. It's fabulous.
Where did you see it?
I saw it down at River East downtown.
Okay.
Because there was a small showing. This is a little in behind the scenes.
Oh, so wait, you guys didn't see it like a month and a half ago?
No.
No.
There was a small showing in a local theater in the suburbs of Chicago, and it was sold out right away.
Yeah.
And then it was released in some other theaters in Evanston and downtown. And my wife works downtown. Friday, I drove an hour and a half into Chicago, parked $14 to see it, and I was in a bad mood. And I saw this movie that the theater was packed with 900 souls, and everyone was silent and watching this movie, and it was unbelievable. Talk about a good experience at the theater. That was, like, totally countered so many other experiences. I really, really loved it, and I think it's going to a lot of overlap with my number one movie in terms of themes and what it has to say and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But anyone else, I don't know. You saw it.
I saw it. Specifically because I thought it's the last 2012 film that might make the list.
Right.
And I liked it, but I didn't love it. I think there are parts of that film that work much better than the whole, and I think I know movies well enough to know why she made a lot of the choices that she made. But I think ultimately I didn't like some of the choices that she made.
I liked it a lot when I saw it, didn't necessarily love it, and as time has gone on, I've found myself thinking about it a lot, and it sort of crept higher and higher up on my list. I think it, just as a piece of filmmaking, it's one of the best made movies of the year. Obviously, you would disagree because you didn't like some of the choices, but I just was very impressed by the technique of it. And I also, I think it has some really interesting things to say. I mean, some people may take issue with this, but in the way that Django does about the nature of revenge, a lot of people would say it's justice, and that's true too. But I think revenge was a big part of it, yeah. And I think the movie acknowledges that.
A quick side note, talk about the marketing of 2012. This movie, again, I saw a commercial before, I think yesterday, where it said, the title card, the first words you see are SEAL Team 6
yeah. And
Navy SEALs. And it's not a spoiler, that's the last half hour of a 2.5 hour movie.
There's a new trailer, because they ran the original
that first
trailer
one was so great, though.
For a really long time. And now that
not
it's
the
gonna,
teaser, right? Because the teaser is just nothing. It's all like
no,
Google Maps.
No, that middle one. That's
I'm talking
like
about
not much
the regular trailer. And now that it's going to open wide on Friday, the
13th.
No, it's not. No,
the 11th?
The 11th. They have this new trailer that's very, very different. Yeah. And it's selling a very, very different film. I liked parts of it a lot. I think it has one of the most affecting final shots of the year. I think that was really, really well done.
That's so funny you say that, because that shot I did not like, and I loved so much of the movie.
Goofus and Gallant
know,
over
right?
here.
Wait, which one am I?
I don't know. Do you put away the dishes?
I usually leave them out.
Goofus!
here's my main criticism of the film in a nutshell.
Should have said, put them away!
I think she was deliberately making things confusing to highlight the fact that what these people were trying to do was incredibly hard. And I think she edited the film to be long on purpose to emphasize the length of the search. And I didn't think either of those two things was necessary.
I don't know how to respond to that. Like, that to me, from what I'm not some scholar or some historian.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
I lied in my
you
application.
Should be fake credentials.
Listen. I had to get this job. My wife needs food on her belly.
Family.
On her family. Just reading about some books and articles and watching like the 60 Minutes piece and all the different documentaries after the raid in Abbottabad, all that stuff happened, and learning about the process by which they found him, I mean, you couldn't talk about a more depressing 10 years of like dead ends and false leads. And
no, I thought that part was fascinating.
And the whole, I don't know, I don't have the words because it's still such a fresh movie, but so much of it worked. But I will say this, when it started, I knew, and again, to your point, it was a thing where it's like, well, this is this is on people's top 10 lists, and this is the last big release of 2012. And I knew I'd like it because I really respond to war films and film and conflict. And I even respond to procedural type films, which I knew all this stuff was. And even I even knew, having read some stuff, that it wasn't going to be all SEAL Team 6 storming the
company.
No,
I knew that.
No, I'm just saying, for me, this is about me now.
Right.
When it started, I loved the opening scene. I loved a lot of what it had to say. And by the way, when I say love, I mean, I don't mean,
right.
You know what I'm saying? you don't see that too often. About halfway through, I was kind of a little bored. And I say that specifically because there's some boring parts. And there's some, not boring, but just some mundane kind of day by day by day, step by step by step.
Because she's emphasizing the mundane.
Because that's exactly what happened.
Exactly.
Right. And then by the time those things start to click and this happens and this happens, and again, it's not like a spoiler. Everyone knows what happened. They raid the compound. I mean, the last half hour of that movie is the raid. And I don't think the raid would have been as effective, for me at least, if all that came before it was different. I think that the raid, how it's presented, how it's set up, and how she does it too, like no music, and almost in real time.
No, the raid,
unbelievable.
The raid sequence is one of the most amazingly directed sequences that I've ever seen.
There were two things in the movie that pulled me out for a second, because I felt like, well, that's too much like a movie, but I'm pretty sure both of them happened. One involves her friend at the CIA, who has a meeting planned with a guy, and then one involves the second helicopter during the raid, and both of those things, and we'll get to that in a second with things that are added to feel more like a movie or right. to make it more like a movie. And both times I was like, well, this seems like an unnecessary complication, but no, these are things that happened.
I'm amazed at how realistic the movie was. From, again, I'm no expert, but everything I've read is kind of like, well, this happened here. Even so much, a very specific scene where they go to open a door and someone from behind the door fires. All that stuff is like verbatim what actually happened. Like they're almost like a log, kind of like an Apollo 13 type thing where it's like, at this point, this happened. At this point, this happened. And a lot of it wasn't dramatized, and it's like, that to me is the ultimate, like, experience, you know.
Two things. I think because it was already on a lot of critics' 10 best lists and it was getting all this critical praise, I think I went in with my expectations too high. Yeah. That might be the case. I also thought at certain points, my knowledge of history was spoiling parts of the movie for me. Because at one point, two people meet at a hotel, and the minute they show on the screen where they are, I say, oh, okay, I remember when that happened, and that kind of pulled me out of the film.
The one critique I might have about the movie, and I said this about The Woman in Black, is it's a pretty serious movie, but it, as it should be, it's such a weird like argument in my head, because this movie is about post 9/11 torture, hunt for a terrorist, the murder of people, and I'm thinking, well, I'm not laughing enough. But it's
well, it doesn't have the sort of entertainment value of a Django Unchained or even of maybe your number one movie.
Right.
So it's maybe a movie that you wouldn't return to as often. This year being this year, of course, Zero Dark Thirty is already completely polarizing because there's no movie that we can all just even be sort of in the middle on. Right. Like, Doug really loved it, JB loved it less, but they can both say, like, no, listen, it's good.
Yeah.
No, it's either... Yeah. It's the best movie of the year, or it's that just way overrated. It
speaks
crap.
To our culture
it's
of this. Like, everyone has oh to God, say guys. This Spider-Man's the best, and the
culture of contrariness. The first James Gandolfini scene has a big laugh.
Yeah, unintentionally so, just because he's recognizable to the.
Also, I wanted to point out, and I told these two this before we started the podcast, I was sitting in front of an idiot where every time SEAL Team 6 put plastic explosives on something, this asshole would literally shout in the theater, fire in the hole.
That helped your... I believe you enjoyed the movie more because of that.
No.
If I'm mistaken.
I wanted to take him out. And I didn't spend 10 years looking for him. He just showed up.
The James Gandolfini thing, it kind of speaks to what I said earlier about like a character actor or someone recognizable showing up two-thirds of the movie in, and it's like, oh, that's Tony Soprano coming in. Actually, was also distracted by... Stannis Baratheon showing up in one of the characters, and like, because it's always like, oh, who's that? Because there's a lot of faces, like Mark Duplass shows up, and it's like, oh.
Lincoln does that, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. It's like every couple minutes, it's here's this actor I recognize.
Yeah. But in a here's weird, a friend of the director.
But in a weird way, I thought Jessica Chastain's performance was such that it made me forget other things that she's been in that I didn't like her. I mean, her performance in that film was amazing. I'll give you that. And makes us completely forget The Help.
She was,
I have forgotten The Help because I never saw it.
She, it's so interesting because she is the movie. I mean, and the movie is ostensibly about her, but I don't think that she carries it as much as, let's say, the girl in Beasts of the Southern Wild. I don't think her performance was excellent. Jessica Chastain's performance was very good and excellent, but I don't think it was like, without her, this movie, I think the movie still has legs without her, but she's great. And, it's interesting. I almost wish my point about the very last scene is I wish it wasn't so telegraphed. I wish it was a little more just subtle and like, I don't know.
It made me think deep thoughts.
That's always a good thing.
Jack Handy.
About what one does once one has achieved everything that one has wanted to achieve.
The only thing that you've been working on for 12 years.
Where does one go from there? Right. And that's a pretty interesting existential thing for a movie to have.
Yeah. So I just think it's a pretty great movie. It's fulfilled my needs as like, even the action was good. The deliberative stuff was worth it.
I think everyone should see it.
Yep. J-Bones, your number one movie.
My number one film, and again, I thought this was just me, but it's slowly appearing on other people's 10 best lists.
Does it rhyme with Rear Rums the Room? Here Comes the Boom.
It's Here Comes... You love Here Comes
when
the Boom.
When you do the Scooby-Doo voice, I can't understand what you're saying, except begging for some sort of snack.
It's marijuana. I'm begging for marijuana.
I beg to differ. That was Astro, not Scooby.
I'm completely lost. I thought the single most entertaining film of the year was Moonrise Kingdom. It was one of only two films that I went back to the theater to see twice. thinking, was I tricked the first time? But no, I wasn't. And I think, where's my brain? Filmmaker.
Wes Anderson.
Wes Anderson sort of lost his way for a while, that he was making films that looked like bad imitations of Wes Anderson films. And here I mean Life Aquatic and Darjeeling Limited, and especially Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is, you could have an animated Wes Anderson film that's just like a Wes Anderson film. And I think in Moonrise Kingdom, he recaptured something that was essential to the success of Rushmore and especially the Royal Tenenbaums, that there is an essential sweetness to the film that I think was missing in the other three. And there are moments in the film that I'll remember forever. Amazing acting. Of course, set design like no one's business. He made it in 16mm, which I didn't quite know the first time I saw it, and then I was informed the second time I saw it. As Patrick himself pointed out, there's a scene where the two leads dance on a beach, and it's one of the most touching things I saw all year. My number one film of the year is Moonrise Kingdom.
And again, we've talked before about how good those two kids are.
In the summer show, right?
And how it's kind of a fluke, because it's the kind of performance you can only get from kids who aren't aware, really, of the choices that they're making.
Right.
I liked it a lot. Had I extended this to a top 15 or a top 20, chances are it would have been on there.
And again, if we had made this top 15, like those crazies at the Onion AV Club, Lincoln would have made my top 15, Looper would have made my top 15, and I'm pretty sure Zero Dark would have made my top 15.
Do you guys want to do five more?
Oh, shoot.
Not tonight, what? Geraldine.
I've only seen 10 movies this year.
I haven't even brought up the Three Stooges.
What is have you noticed the Three Stooges is getting reassessed at the end of the year? It's making people's underrated list.
Devin Faraci named it as one of the most underrated movies of the year.
That's insane. I haven't seen it, but
my number one movie.
What is your number one movie? If I didn't know.
Say it together.
Here Comes the Boom.
Cloud Atlas.
Cloud Atlas is my favorite movie of the year.
Made me watch Here Comes the Boom.
Sucker.
And then you also made me watch Pitch Perfect. Which is also making lists. Whatever.
Yeah, right. My favorite movie of the year is Cloud Atlas.
It is an indefensible choice.
Well, you say that having not seen it.
I've been told by people I trust.
He saw the trailer.
That it would whip me into a frenzy.
I don't know that it would whip you into a frenzy. I don't know if you would like it as much as I did. Maybe you would really love it. Who knows?
I think you'd like it.
I will eventually see it in your basement, sir.
Is that a euphemism?
All the things that Doug said earlier about, I think, seeking a friend for the end of the world, I think apply to me with...
Steve Carell in Cloud Atlas was great.
Cloud Atlas.
The CGI really obscures the fact that it's actually not Tom Hanks. It's Steve Carell.
It tells six different stories across thousands of years, I would say. Maybe hundreds, I guess.
Hundred.
Okay.
From like 1830 something to like 2144.
I don't remember the timestamp on True True.
it might be a little later than that.
Really it's later than that. Hate it. Like, really hate it.
How long did it play?
3 weeks, about.
Yeah. I think it played actually only the duration of the actual film, which is 3 weeks long.
A few outlets, including...
I tease because I love...
Time Magazine, have named it the worst movie of the year, which, of course, is just horseshit, because they want to take this movie... Because
everyone knows that John Carter is
use
the worst
it as
of the
a
year.
Whipping boy. I love so much... of what the movie has to say, so much of what it attempts. You want to talk about in a movie that's
ambitious. Jesus Christ.
And at the end, I cried a lot. Not necessarily because it's not a sad movie. I found myself crying not just because I was moved so much by what the movie had to say. I was crying because it existed. That these people, Tom Tykwer and more specifically the Wachowskis, had the guts to basically finance it themselves, to get it made, to do the things that they do in the movie, a movie that has so much sort of optimism and positivity inside of this 3-hour epic that covers comedy and historical drama and science fiction. It's all over the place. I've never seen a movie like it. I know for a fact I will never see a movie like it again.
Wait, why do you know that?
I just know I won't. How How would you ever see that again?
You wouldn't. I mean, it would be something else.
Patrick can see into the future,
but it wouldn't be like this. You know what I mean? I mean. I think you. It won't be.
It's
this.
It's not like anyone's ever going to remake it.
We're not arguing about this movie, obviously. Yeah. But I think that it's maybe. I mean,
I think I'll see a movie that might be special in a different way, but I'll never see a movie that's special. I don't think in the way that's semantics.
I guess.
Whatever. You started this.
I just want the pro
podcast.
Clearly, if you love movies, you need to see it.
I just really loved it, and I saw the trailer, and it was like, well, that's going to be something. Like when we saw the trailer for Sucker Punch, it was like, I don't know what that is, but that's going to be. Something, I go back to something you said years ago. I don't even remember what movie you were talking about. You said, well, it's going to be the engine or the caboose.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought about Cloud Atlas. And so I went in very cautious.
Sure. I use that expression a lot with my students.
And
they're like, what's a caboose?
For me, it was the engine. I just really, really, really loved the movie.
It's fascinating. I saw it this weekend. It is unlike anything you'll ever see. And I think it benefits...
Or anything you ever will see. Exactly. I win the fight!
It benefits greatly...
He's the looper.
...from talking about it, I think. Sure. I think it's... You had a visceral reaction to it that I didn't have. I still sat and watched it and was like, wow, this is...
And again, maybe it goes back to this stupid argument. I saw it in the theater. IMAX, no less.
It would be beautiful in basement, IMAX. You know, it would be beautiful. So. And by the way, your basement is a wonderful place to see movies.
It's almost IMAX.
It's IMAX. Omnimax. It benefits though, because after I came upstairs and buttoned my pants, we talked about this. I like to watch movies pantsless. We talked about it for about a half an hour, 45 minutes, and it was late and we had to go, and I wish we could have talked about it more because it really does benefit from like, wait, this, because there's so much going on, but it's not like overly confusing. You can get it. It's understandable. The plot threads are all, but it benefits from like really... taking a hard look at it, taking a second look at it to really, really examine it, to focus on it. I don't know. It's just, none of it's ugly. It's beautiful. Each one of them could have been its own movie. All that you said, there's six timelines. It could have been its own thing.
Well, that's one of the criticisms that was constantly leveled against the movie. And a lot of the criticisms would make me crazy, but it's a hard thing when you really love something to read all these people bashing it. It's like somebody making fun of your kid. It's like, oh, come on. You don't see what I see in
this.
Yeah,
right.
That one of the criticisms was that none of these would stand up on their own as its own movie. And my argument to that is they don't have to.
No.
They're in one movie.
And honestly, like, they're not supposed to because
that's like saying a short story wouldn't work as a novel. It doesn't have to. It's a great short story.
No,
dipshit.
That's a crazy criticism.
There's one of the stories in particular I want to see a movie of, and it's Neo-Soul.
Yeah.
I think that's 2144. The future after the fall is way past that. And that is like, it's what Speed Racer should have been, maybe. It's so interesting.
I so appreciate the Wachowskis trying to push things forward in so many ways. And just knowing some of their biography and what a struggle it has been for them. The way that so much of that is sort of worked into the movie and what the movie has to say about human nature and our need to be better to one another just really, really moved me.
I liked what it had to say also about, in a weird way, I'm thinking a lot about, I'm expecting a child in March. That's the first time I've said this on a podcast.
That's right. Big reveal.
Big reveal. I'm expecting a child. And I think part of that is me thinking my brains out about my life and about the future. And you guys are both fathers, so you know where I am right now. You've probably been there yourself. And I'm thinking about, and not to sound morbid, but about death and about the afterlife and about what it all means. And there's so much that's said in Cloud Atlas, and it's kind of specific, you know, in a lot, in some ways, and very ambiguous in others, but like,
yeah, it's not threads, really a subtle movie necessarily.
Yeah. The threads and how humans are tied together and there's connections made that can't be broken. Physically.
Our actions.
Yeah.
Have meaning and effects.
And it's not religious at all. It's not about religion. It's not about God. It's about just our actions are, impactful.
Do our actions echo through eternity?
They do.
I think
you
so.
You better believe it. Like a multitude of drops in the ocean. Or the ocean is a multitude of drops. Douglas, you are number one choice?
My number one, and I'm glad I'm last because there's so much to say about this, is Argo.
Yes.
It was single-handedly the most delightful, fun, exciting cinematic experience I had at the theater this year. I cannot believe that in 2012 or 2013, Ben Affleck has become director, that this goofy guy who's like the weird minor character in Good Will Hunting, who's, you know, kind of the
suspect,
right, the heavy in some early movies, and he's in, you know, School Ties and all this, like, that this guy is this director who's made he hasn't made a bad movie.
No.
It was Patrick 7, it was my 3. It was movie joy.
Yeah.
It was a very, very well-made film, and obviously you had brought up Hugo before. John Chambers is sort of a hero of mine, because I knew about his career helping World War II veterans get prosthetics, which leads to Planet of the Apes. But when the trailer for this came out, and I was like, what? He was an undercover CIA agent? He's a superhero! Right. My guy is a superhero. And John Goodman turns in a really great performance as him.
Yeah.
The problem is he's in a movie with so many other great actors. We keep being reminded of how great Alan Arkin is. There's a scene where Affleck and Arkin just sit there on the back lot.
Yeah.
And they have this discussion. And in any other film, you would see, well, we have to cut that out. That doesn't...
Exposition, exposition, exposition.
That doesn't advance the story. Right. It's one of the greatest scenes in the film.
It pulls off a really great trick where it's this very tense historical drama for like the first third, and then all of a sudden Ben Affleck has this revelation about the plan that we're going to sneak in as a movie crew, and he's in Hollywood rubbing elbows, and it turns into this Hollywood satire that's very entertaining and a little bit silly by design, and it's like, how are these two things existing in the same movie?
I'll even go further. Amazing. It's like the first third is the thing you just mentioned. Yeah. That's the second third.
And the last third is crazy.
And the last third is like another totally different like departure. Like it's a total dramatization. None of the stuff actually happened, which a lot of people, that's a critique.
Every once in a while, I would get pulled out when they can't answer the phone. That's the thing that
it's kind of annoying. Like, but
this is a movie, guys.
It's totally, but it's the choices he made as a director. And I've heard some critiques where people said, "Well, that's not what actually happened. They actually got away fairly easily after all
that's
the hard
compelling.
Work." Yeah, exactly. It's like, well,
that's
so
drama.
They didn't have a car chasing the plane or something at the end. It's
but
like,
in a weird way, that contributes to the film being about movies.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, we can't use the original ending. That doesn't work. And then in the closing credits, we get to see how eerily accurate the actors they cast look like the real people. That was cool.
It was such a neat movie. And I, there's a lot of overlaps, I thought, with Zero Dark Thirty in very kind of concrete, superficial ways that, like, in this sequence that this happens and this sequence this happens, there's lots of similarities between the two movies. And honestly, they were my one and two. And it speaks to, like, what I like in movies, obviously. But I gave the edge to Argo. Not to say that it's not even better than Zero Dark Thirty. It's just it gave me more of a delightful.
It has a different energy.
It is totally just like
Argo's certainly more fun.
Yes, yes, that's another theme of this show.
And it's amazing how tense those last 30 minutes are. Again, which everyone has pointed out, we know how it ends,
right?
Yeah.
And yet, it's so gripping.
But it also
Apollo 13 syndrome. Right. That's the mark of a movie maker.
Yeah.
Right.
It says some things, though, too, that it's not just a superficial light, like wacky Hollywood satire. No. It says things
about...
It's
not Ocean's 11 with the hostage crisis.
It says some things about America's relationships with the world. It says some things about... It's like lots of parallels from the 70s to now. That's why I think the overlapping Zero Dark Thirty thing, too, also.
The opening 10 minutes were probably the scariest 10 minutes I've seen in a movie this year. The siege on the embassy is terrifying.
It's terrifying.
Very scary.
Yeah.
And we had been talking about how films were mismarketed and misrepresented in trailers. I thought the original trailer for Argo, I don't know of anyone who didn't watch that trailer and say, I want to see that.
Because it's so... And again, if they didn't say this was true, you would say this is the most ridiculous thing
ever.
It was
one of the best trailers of the year.
Yeah.
Which just proves, not to sound cliched or lame, but like the human things that actually happen in history are like the best stories, you know?
Great use of Aerosmith.
you're doodling Aerosmith
again,
on your sheet.
Great.
I'm writing Mrs. Steven Tyler.
A really, really good year for movies. So much stuff that, you know, there's all this stuff that we're all saying, oh, that could have made mine.
Yeah.
You know,
an embarrassment of riches, because now, if you haven't figured it out, they're dumping the turkeys in January.
Texas Chainsaw 3D!
I felt like a couple years ago that, like, the 9 and 10 spots were like, I want to give this movie a shout-out, or I want to, like, champion this thing, and the rest of my list is, like, everyone else's.
This movie was a sequel to Iron Man, which I liked.
I didn't like the fact that he invented an element.
Let's real quick,
yeah,
run down our top tens. JB, you go first, and then
number one, Moonrise Kingdom.
Go backwards. You got to go the other way. 10 to 1.
I will not do that. Number 10, The Grey. Number 9, Paranorman. Number 8, Django Unchained. Number 7, Safety Not Guaranteed. Number 6, Woman in Black. Number 5, The Master. Number 4, Beasts of the Southern Wild. Number 3, Argo. Number 2, Cabin in the Woods. And number 1, Moonrise Kingdom.
Douglas.
Number 10, Frankenweenie. Number 9, Here Comes the Boom. I'm kidding. I won't do this the whole time. I know how annoyed JB gets at my jokes. I'm just trying to be fun.
Number 7, Safe House.
Have you seen that? So good.
Oh, I thought you meant Dream House.
That was last year.
Number 10, Life of Pi. Number 9, The Hunger Games. Number 8, Lincoln. Number 7, 21 Jump Street. Number 6, The Innkeepers. Number 5, Django Unchained. Number 4, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. Number 3, Looper. Number 2, Zero Dark Thirty. And number 1, Argo.
My number 10, The Innkeepers. Number 9, The Queen of Versailles. Number 8, Magic Mike. Number 7, Argo. Number 6, Cabin in the Woods. Number 5, Looper. Number 4, Safety Not Guaranteed. Number 3, Zero Dark Thirty. Number 2, Django Unchained. And number 1, Cloud Atlas.
Such an interesting
list. Really contrarian.
We have such different lists, and I love it, because I love what you all had to say about stuff, and I like what you had to say about my choices, and I think they're all... It's a great year for good movies.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks for a great 2012. On to 2013.
No more pull-ups.